Hey everybody, and welcome to episode 573 of Video Game Apocalypse. I'm your host, Michael Raparez, coming to you from the Vinny Garcia Memorial Studio of the Airwaves.
Vinny?
If you want it to be the U Memorial Studio of the Airwaves, go to patreon.com/lasertime and join us at the $20 level, or yeah, if you just want bonus shows, or to support us financially, join us at the $5 level. Who's joining me now?
Meh, closer to fine, Chris Antista. I just saw the Indigo Girls.
Congratulations.
The reference to that.
Now you can be welcomed into the secret society. Oh, I've said too much. And
Matthew Allen, big. We were talking about EA a second ago, and his head.
And joining us for the first time ever, special guest
Phil Keeling. He's in the game.
Ooh, that's a good follow-up callback. Phil, where might people have heard you, or where can they hear more of you?
Oh, well, I am the co-host of a show called Pixel Lit. We are the best podcast dedicated to video game novelizations because we are the only podcast dedicated to video game novelizations. We cornered the market, and I think if there were other ones, we'd still be much, much better than them. So I think there's that something.
Yeah.
I think it's too tough a job for many people to tackle. Because every time I try and look up information about these books, it's some snarky horseshit somebody wrote about reading a description of it. Because most people don't take the time to crack these Blaster Master books.
Yeah.
open them up. If it's not in the Halo series, most people haven't read it. They're just flipping about it.
I love the Halo books.
The Halo books are what we read when we want to take a nice break and actually enjoy something for a minute.
Now, Phil, I read the Mass Effect prequel novel. That shit was actually quite good.
Okay. We have not gotten to the Mass Effect stuff yet.
Oh, I have to ask, a few years ago, Michael and I were sent a book. It's the most meta shit ever. It was a choose-your-own-adventure video game book.
Oh yeah,
but but video games are basically
promo for this. Actually,
yeah, but like video games are choose your own adventure. They're choose your own adventures, so it's like very meta and twisted in that way.
Was it one of the old Nintendo ones that they did in the 90s? I want to say
no. This was like a recent thing.
I didn't even I didn't even know they were still making those.
And I little question for Phil because I haven't heard the show yet, but I am ultra intrigued and ask you a ton of questions off mic. Something I didn't ask you: can you think of like a cardinal sin that all game novelizations commit, or maybe they should avoid?
That's a really good question. You would think that it would be going too far off of base with the source material. It's actually when you follow it too closely.
Yeah.
Mm. We have read books where it might as well be a playthrough of the game. That's gone from everything from Mega Man 2 to one of the Halo books.
What a great medium to do that. What?
Yeah. I'm not going to give it away, but there was one book where, you know, in the format of video games, it isn't enough to go, I have to flip this switch and move on. You have to flip three switches and the three different wings, etc. And then you get to move on. If you were adapting it, it would be okay to just say, there's just one switch, and let's make it really exciting to get to that switch.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah,
this particular book said, he went to that, and he went over down the hall, and he turned the switch, and he came back to the forum, and he went back down the second hall,
Laura,
and he flipped the switch.
In a grid-like fashion, and hit the second switch.
My problem with all the Bethesda novelizations is you really shouldn't read them until, like, the 14th printing. They're just too full of bugs otherwise.
Just too many,
unfinished.
Once the community can fix it for them.
Right, the mod. You're going to have the mod. The fanfic.
Very, very good.
It
got me thinking, we were talking about that earlier, and, like, the books I know of and, you know, laugh at are from the 8-bit era when, like, the 8-bit era, the video games then were the best scene of a movie over and over again with all of the narrative cut out. And I guess that's what those new novelizations have to fill in, even if the designers of the game hadn't thought of it yet.
Yeah. The best ones we've read have been the ones that follow what's happening in the game, if it is based on that specific game, but will like throw you every other chapter or so something quick of like some insights or some moments that you wouldn't normally get, so you know why you're reading it, because the whole point is like, why are we adapting this? What's even the point It's kind of like the Romeo and Juliet song by the Indigo Girls.
Hey! Hey!
Why are there so many covers from it? We already did it. Right,
that was like a Dire Straits song before it was an Indigo Girls.
Oh, well, fuck it. I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know.
Pixel it, ladies and gentlemen. Pixel it. Find it where you get podcasts. I'm probably going to after this.
But yeah, I went and listened to it, and I decided I have to get one of these guys on the show because this is great. You have a fantastic like three-part series about Sacred and Terrible Air, which is the novel written by the writer of Disco Elysium.
Mm-hmm.
I forget
that
his name.
That was fun. That was a lot of fun.
Like, heavier than you'd expect from something tangential to video games.
We don't read literature very often, and that's what this guy was aiming for. Whether or not he achieved it, I'm still a little up in the air about, but I admire the hell out of it. But by the end of it, I was like, good call, making this a game. Good call. That's probably better.
The best way to approach it.
Oh, the guy can write characters, you know, and I think that was the strongest thing about it. Actually, the strongest thing about it was the most surprising thing. When you've got a world that is being consumed by this horrible mist, the pale, and you've got these like Soviet-era war machines and revolution and Leninists on every street corner. And the best part of the book was these three guys nostalgically thinking about these girls they met this one time. And and how awesome that was. And it was like, holy shit, that's so good. It was who
the finding
can't
moment
with
in
that.
Their lives.
Yeah.
It mixed that, like, I think you said, it's like it's a very tender coming of age story mixed with a horrific crime story.
Yes, just absolutely horrific crime story with a lot of conversations with that one guy from the political science 101 class you met sophomore year who will not shut the fuck up. So it's and you'd like it. Sometimes you're like, yeah, you're right, but please shut up.
Yeah. Tell me less about Mazovian socioeconomics, please.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk about Bakunin anymore. We're good.
Chris, just nod. We'll get through this together. Just nod.
I want to know this stuff. I absolutely do. And I think Michael's
like
going to talk about...
Like, this is the Ghostbusters, and this is Ray and Egon are talking, and then me and Chris over here decide.
I got a Bill Murray cigarette dangling from my mouth.
Talking about Twinkies. Yeah, tell them about the Twinkie, Chris.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, it's only going to get more artsy, because this week's top five is about, what am I calling this, beautiful flops. Games that were beloved by critics, and yet did not sell well at all. Like, the commercial... Critical successes, commercial flops.
Yeah, I think it just keeps reminding me we're at an odd time in video games where, like, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth came out and is underperforming, but it's not a flop. And most games that came out the previous generation, if they reviewed well and shit the bed, there's always, like, a remaster that can come out.
Yeah.
You know, kind of, you can get more life out of it. So it's nice to be at a time where things don't fail as hard. I say that like on yet another day where a bunch of great game companies get closed. But it feels like things don't really fail as hard as they used to, especially if they're reviewed well and people talk about it.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, that like we get a lot of things that like sell well, like you would consider this to be a pretty good success, like over 1.5 million copies. That's
yeah, I think what like, Final Fantasy Rebirth sold, if any of these games sold that, they would be fine.
Yeah, when, you're, when your sales back. Figures could like fuel the economy of a small European country, it's probably not a failure by any stretch, but except for the CEOs.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, it doesn't pay off the investments needed to make a huge AAA modern game.
Right, that's why we're seeing fewer and fewer of them, and I, you know, feel like they're more in danger than ever now.
The new model going forward is that there's just going to be one AAA game made per year. All the different companies are going to collaborate on it. It's going to be a moonshot effort.
It's been a year of me playing a lot of high profile AAA games that are hit that $70 mark, and it's just like, I don't know if it's that $70 mark. It's just like, wow, this is devoid of any real soul, and like Helldivers is so fun and cheap.
Yeah.
Why can't we all just do that? Helldivers barely works. A patch went through this week that fixed things in the game that were supposed to be there months ago. and no one's mad about it.
No, people are definitely mad about it.
Yeah, people are definitely mad about it, but like, yeah, just a scrappier and take more chances is what I hope to see again, because some of these are incredibly beautiful, but a hard sell to the mainstream. But I feel like there's never been a better time for that kind of game to pull through, as long as it's produced reasonably inexpensively, like some of these games were not. But yeah, podcast, YouTubers, Twitch, like there's a lot of great ways to push. There's no reason for a game that gets a 9 or a 10 to fail anymore, it feels like.
No.
If you get a 7 or an 8, hey, you may have some struggles, but like 9s and 10s seem like a guaranteed success now more than ever.
So I think it all depends on your definition of failure, right? So like, yeah. I think the problem is like, you might look at a game and be like, that sold 1 million units. Okay, by any definition, that most people would say that's a success. Unless you are shareholders of a public company,
yeah.
And that public company has told you that the game is going to sell more than that. And mm-hmm. So I think even some of these on our list might be cases that were like, they sold okay, but it's like they were expected to sell 5 or 6 times as much, so they're considered failures.
Some of them I'm like, that's impossible. You could not have had high expectations for this.
At least one of them was mostly a victim of bad timing. But let's just dive in with...
Number 5.
You died. I don't know how or even where. But your body was remade in the Well of Souls, and somehow it worked. The well restored your soul to your body, and it worked.
Body?
That's from the very beginning of which game?
Dark Souls?
No, you're close. I mean, it is in the fantasy area.
That's Kingdoms of Amalur, right?
Yeah, Kingdoms of Amalur. Reckoning of 2012, which I put kind of at the front of this list, partly because this is an interesting story to talk about, and partly because it actually did okay. Mm-hmm. It sold 1.3 million in its first year when it came out.
Best thing baseball ever gave us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Kurt Schilling founded the publisher 38 Studios. But it has like an 80 on Metacritic. People talk fondly about it all the time. Guests on the show, for example, like you suggested this, Phil. And yeah. I had never, like, for whatever reason, I gave it a miss the first time it came out. And so I played a bunch of it last night. It's like, oh, it's like if you had an Elder Scrolls game with the gameplay of like one of the early God of War games.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's very much just a no-nonsense, like run around and hack and slash through things and get XP and talk to people and get quests. And yeah, it strips out a lot of the fat of big open world RPGs, but it's a lot of fun.
I think that's what's ironic about it, is that the reason it ended up failing is because Kurt Schilling ended up taking so much money, including from the government of Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Yes.
Literally, I want to say it was some ungodly number, like $220 million or something insane. Because he wanted to make he had always played Avalon Hill games and stuff like that. And he decided that qualifies me to make the next big MMO, which is what this was supposed to be. And you got R.A. Salvatore.
This was supposed
for
to be like the
and...
proof of concept for an MMO,
and just the hubris of like it's Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, as if there's more of these.
Right.
We want to make sure people can distinguish. Like, just call it what it is. Don't confuse people and make them think this is part of a broader thing they need to know more about.
That's always like a sign of hubris when you title something like it's going to be part of a big franchise.
The
like,
game should
really
have been called
the cart before the horse.
It should have been called Introduction to Kingdoms of Amalur.
It wasn't like some other franchises that someone who's recording may have worked on where like we actually needed to give it a subtitle for legal reasons so to make it distinct. Like, no one was fighting over Kingdoms of Amalur. Yeah. Like, oh yeah, no, that's not an SEO risk.
Except for the small Sri Lankan village of Amalur.
Yeah, that's all.
They didn't have their website up back then.
They never found
someone
out.
Someone please think of the Sri Lankans, right?
Oh, please.
But yeah, this had some big talent behind it. Grant Kirkhope was the composer
who
worked on the
Banjo
bunch of Rare games. Yeah, it had, like you said, R.A. Salvatore. The lead designer also worked on Elder Scrolls a bunch, and especially Oblivion before this. And so,
Todd McFarlane doing the
art. Todd McFarlane, yes, was the art director. What? That's crazy. Yeah. That must have been incredibly expensive. So the game had a budget of about $30 million. 28 million dollars of that came from EA, which they it co-published it with 38 Studios and had loaned them the money. Apparently, most of the money that the game made went to repaying that loan. So I think Lincoln Chafee, the then governor of Rhode Island, said like it would have had to have sold $2 million to pay back the money that was borrowed, just to break
even. 2 million copies,
like 2 million copies. Yeah. Part of that, I don't think it was factored into the budget that I saw on Wikipedia, but they did take a $75 million loan from the state of Rhode Island. Woo! So that's a lot of money. Woo! They didn't make back. They couldn't make payroll. They shuttered the studio. It didn't
yet
last.
Another
it was,
reason
it was a whole fiasco.
I've never been to Rhode Island.
Just that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you only partially funded a video incompetent video game studio. What business do I have
and
in
this
state?
It was a good idea. Like, we'll dangle this money and we'll get a video game studio to move here, and it'll be hundreds of jobs for Rhode Islanders. And it's like, well,
it's not uncommon. It's not totally infeasible that a game with EA support could sell 2 million copies over the course of whatever a game's life cycle would end up becoming shortly after this, because it did get a re-release.
Yeah,
I think 2 million sounds too low to recoup. Like, if you factor in marketing costs and the budgets we've heard, is like, no, there's no way. No, it was. That sounds more like it needs to sell like 10 million copies, and no way. Yeah, like, trying to establish new IP.
Well, I think the $75 million wasn't for the game, but for the studio. And the studio had another hit on their hands and could become the kingdom of Amalur Factory everyone thought it would become.
Yeah.
They were making this while they were off on the side trying to make their big damn MMO and pouring money into that.
MMO.
There are also stories of like just. The quality of the offices and every, you know, just
it was the Doom guys that eventually did that. Remember they did the first Deus Ex game. What was that studio name of that?
Ion Storm,
similar deal where it was like just the building itself was just like, what are you doing? You should be making this out of a garage.
The garbage cans have bidets.
Yeah. Well, I remember that the defining thing about Ion Storm's offices was that they had like a giant domed skylight because they were like on the top floor of this huge building. And like, guess where you live, guys? You're in fucking, was it Dallas? Like, you're in the middle of Texas.
Yeah, you're going to roast, man.
Yeah, you don't want to have a domed skylight over your office in the middle of the day.
And
you
also,
have
turned like, yourself most into game devs darken the office that they work in because they're working at computer screens all day long. Like, used to be a joke at some of the companies I'm at, like, go into QA departments, they will black out the windows. Mm-hmm. Like, they want it dark.
Instead, you turn yourself into ants under a giant magnifying glass.
What is this, a game developer for ants?
Yes, it is. Kings of Amalur is pretty fun. I guess Ari Salvatore didn't like write the script. He did what George R. R. Martin did for Elden Ring. That he came
put
up
his
with
name
the,
on a thing.
Came up with a couple names,
the setting, the history. You know, I'm going to do all the backstory, and then you're going to pick up where I left off. But the concept is sort of interesting in that you are the character. Well, this is your deal.
I've never seen someone whose fate was just missing. Not even when I was drunk as the King of Ballads. This doesn't make sense. All mortal creatures have a place in the pattern. You should have one too, dead or not. If this is true, and I'm not saying I believe it, then your path is yours to determine.
Yeah, I kind of like that. That's just a very meta way of saying, like, you can do whatever you want now. You're not like the rest of us game characters who are bound to our scripts. You can break our fates if you want. You can determine who lives and who dies.
Man,
isn't that
like
amazing?
Elon Musk sycophant fans. Happy to be your NPC, Elon.
And it's just basically just describing the condition of being a game character with freedom of choice, I guess.
And I'm told Phil likes this.
I have not
played it.
I have beaten this game twice.
Wow.
I have beaten it twice. It's a huge game. Mm-hmm. I don't remember jack about the story.
All right.
That's
that aligns with my experience with this game is just like, it's fine, but there's nothing that's really memorable about it. Like, that's its biggest crime that it commits is like, it's, you know, like, in my memory, and Phil, since you've played it twice, you poor, beautiful human soul, you, like... It lines up with Dragon Quest or Dragon's Age Inquisition. You know, like I keep maybe conflating the two titles. Is it anything like that, or am I way off base?
I think that's a great comparison in the sense that it taps into something in the addictive part of your brain when you want a nice solid action RPG. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go here and I'm gonna beat this quest and go here and beat this quest. And, oh, I can respec and I can do the heavy weapons now instead of the mage stuff. And there's a lot of freedom for that. So you can really just go all over the place and kind of vaguely, oh yeah, there's a story, I guess. And really just get into your little power fantasy trip. And it's a great big world and it's pretty and it feels really good to play, but there's nothing at all about the substance to the storyline or anything like that.
What about the world?
The world's itself? It's pretty.
Yeah.
And it's like most fantasy open world things are, like, I got a desert area, I got a swamp area, I got a mountain area. It's gorgeous. It really is. And I never even played the remastered version.
I thought it was interesting they have like two different kinds of name. Elves. Like there's the Fae, which are like, you know, the elves from like old European folklore, that they're mysterious and magical and stay away from humans and can fuck with reality. And then there's like, I forget what they're called, but then there's like the more mundane elves that just like hang out with all the humans.
I mean, to be fair, most fantasy has like two kinds of elves, but typically it's just dark elves and high elves, which is racist sounding as fuck.
But this is like, you know, Lord of the Rings elves versus D&D elves that like run taverns and shit.
Okay.
Yeah.
And my weird memory of this is that I was working at PC Gamer, I think, at the time, and they had really good data on what their readers or PC gamers were looking forward to. That I think it was paid data. It was like valuable data that I hope other game companies paid for. And it was, you know, not done to swing what we were doing, but we would make a list of the thing gamers were most looking forward to. And then it's like, Kingdoms of Amalur is reviewing well. It does not show up in like the top 50 or 100 of games people are looking at. Skyrim came out 3 months beforehand, and people are still like, that's still in people's, I'm looking forward to this whenever I get paid kind of thing. And like, that is like number two on the list. This game came out 3 months before Skyrim. So if
it came out after Skyrim, I think.
3 months after Skyrim. So, like, if you were in the market for an open world fantasy game, are you not entertained? What would you do? Most people were playing Skyrim for months, if not years, afterwards. And I know they're different gameplay types, but like, you're introducing a new thing that competes directly with Skyrim Elder Scrolls right when Skyrim comes out. Probably not a good idea.
Oh yeah, that was and it would be real easy, I think, to say, well, poor Kingdoms of Amalur, Skyrim was such a global phenomenon that that it just got stomped. Part of that's true, but it also was just didn't sink its hooks into you the same way Skyrim did.
No.
IGN gave it 0.5 less than Skyrim. So a 9 to a 9.5, Kingdom of Amalur and Skyrim.
I didn't realize it was that close. That is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, whatever, review scores, you don't have to put too much stock in it. But, it did review well. It reviewed pretty goddamn well.
I think that's the criteria for this list, for the most part, right? Is all of these.
Yeah, all of these reviewed well. We should probably move along to...
Number 4.
7 angels have fallen to Earth. Big mistake. We're going to tear out their souls and lock them in this prison for eternity.
I'll give you guys a hint. This is the catalyst for this list. An HD remaster of this came to Switch this week.
Oh, El Shaddai?
Yeah, El Shaddai, Ascension of the Metatron.
Eshad, the kids call it.
Yeah, of course.
First of all, why would you title it something so welcoming and easy to understand?
Yeah, exactly. And it has so much to do with the characters and the storyline that you're experiencing.
I just remember, I set it out. My girlfriend's like, what? What is happening? I'm like, my fucking asshole co-podcasters won't stop talking about El Shaddai. And she's like, that name, why would anybody use that? She knew exactly what that meant, and like, why would anybody name a gain off? I should have remembered to say this anecdote. I should have remembered what she said, but it's means it's probably some like Eastern religion or incense or something like that, that she would know exactly what it meant, and none of us did. Nobody who plays games did.
Nope. I know the Metatron is an angel, so this
oh, he's a Transformer.
Sure. Yeah, Metatron. You know, he's the leader of the Decepticons.
Yeah, he turned into a gun, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The Decepticons. Oh, that's what my mom would call them.
Exactly. So, El Shaddai, one of the lower scoring games on this list. Metacritic, the cumulative average is 78. It did get some 9s and 10s, some pretty high scores. People either really liked it or didn't think much of it. It got about, I think, by the end of 2011, per Wikipedia, it sold about 85,200 copies. Not great. Oof. Pretty low. But
it's weird. If that's what it sold in Japan, it's somehow a hit. If that's what it sold in America, you're fucked.
Yeah, exactly. it was citing a Japanese story, but I'm not entirely sure if that's just Japan or if that's worldwide. Looking at VGCharts.com, it seems to be worldwide. But it's not a wonderful sales story, but it is a really interesting game.
Yes,
in that like it has like a really vivid, almost impressionistic art style, where you are playing as this guy named Enoch, who is the clerk of heaven, and like this is based on like a story set before the great
heaven
flood.
What can I do for you?
Yeah. These seven angels have gone down to earth because they love mankind so much and they want to be worshipped as gods. And then they set up a pocket dimension and build this tower in this city. And so you have to fight your way to them. And the actual action of it is kind of a very straightforward, streamlined Devil May Cry, where it's a character action game. You're slashing with one of three weapons. You have the arc, which is like a sword. You have some other things that like fire little bullets, and then you have like, you know, big fists that double as a shield, and you just beat up on enemies, and then you go through like a side scroller stage, and then you're wandering around beating up on enemies again, and then this guy shows up and saves your game for you.
Hey, what's the matter? You don't trust me? I guess. Well, I'd say so far, so good. You know I could never say no to you. After all, you are the Lord.
So that is Lucifer talking on a cell phone with God. He's apparently played by Jason Isaacs. I'm not hearing it, but that's what IMDb says.
Jason Isaacs has done so much game stuff that you wouldn't even know or recognize. Like when I was working on, I think it was Star Trek Online, he had an appearance in that game. Like he's done stuff since Harry Potter, basically.
Well, yeah.
Who is he in Harry Potter?
It was
Draco's dad.
Yeah, Lucius Malfoy.
Right.
Lucius Malfoy.
Right. The big in that Peter Pan
wig.
Movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and he was in Death of Stalin, which was fantastic. But yeah, this
I'm telling you, for me it was the fucking name. Like don't make like it doesn't have to be War of Sword for me to be interested, but like the name instantly implied, like, do I have to know a ton of shit before I pick this thing up? And I remember Grimm, like, you know, back when we all had offices, and he's like, you guys should come see this. This is really stark and weird. And, like, nothing, it looks, there's so many things that look like it now. Nothing looked like it back then. Like, Jesus, this is a really interesting art style.
Yeah, it's really striking to look at. Things will happen every once in a while where, like, the tone completely changes. You're in this, like, each of the floors of this tower are dedicated to a specific fallen angel, and one of them, like, will taunt you sometimes. She'll show up as, like, an outline of a face and blow wind into the stage while floating past, and then, like, these gigantic waves of just, like, clouds will start rising up, and you can just climb on them, and they're actually essential for carrying you forward through the stage. There's one stage where it just goes all silly, and it's just like, oh, it's about the Nephilim, which are the offspring of human and angels, but they look like little Japanese mascots or something. Like they're just basically hot dogs with little flappy arms, and they push giant beach balls around and stuff like that. But
Yeah, there's a lot of
I'm from Florida. I know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
there's a lot of Old Testament mythology woven in, and some of it's like apocrypha or stuff that might be like almost like Kabbalah stuff, right? Where it's like, oh yeah, like this is maybe mentioned one time, one reference in one verse in the Bible, and then there's lore that you have to really dig. And it's like, so Chris, don't make fun, but I do wish, like, the Bible is ripe source material for fiction. But I don't think it's ever been mined well in the video game medium. Like, there are stories there.
You Wisdom could tell Tree from would the disagree Bible. With you, friend. None of those games. They're very good.
But, like, it's just a shame that, like, okay, so again, this is me talking about the racism of Americans. Perhaps more people would have been interested if it sounded more biblical and less, like, that. The name El Shaddai actually means like I think it's a God. Jewish name, but it means like God. It's like the ultimate God or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it sounds just vaguely Middle Eastern enough where probably a lot of Americans stayed away from it. Like, I don't want nothing to do with that Middle Eastern
also,
stuff.
Also, like, it's supposed to be set in some sort of biblical time, but like the main character wears fucking Wrangler jeans and like patchy armor that flies off as he gets hit, and so
that's
he's
the Metatron, baby.
You're not the Metatron though. You're Enoch. You're a human who's been given immortality.
I'm just saying, the subtitle sounds like a member of George Clinton's band. It's Metatron, the P-Funk All-Stars. Yeah. Come on, now.
Yes, it gets funky.
When I heard the name El Shaddai, I'm like, if this doesn't star Danny Trejo, I want nothing to do with it.
I'm sorry.
It does not. No, I think we live in a world where, how do you pronounce this? Yeez is a popular game.
Kanye?
The Wise game?
Yes. Yeah, Wise
Kanye's
game.
Kanye's mobile game about his mother.
It's the best. It's the best ever.
Is awesome. I can see where that kind of, you're like, nah, they're going to love it. We're going to love El Shaddai.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely a lot of like Talmudic and, you know, apocryphal inspiration in this one. And I actually did a video on YouTube about the history of Christian video games. And this is one that I briefly talked about. And the one that I missed that everyone in the comment section
Messiah?
Brought up. No, I didn't talk about Messiah either, though. It was Dante. Dante's Inferno. Everyone was like, why didn't you talk about that? That game was amazing. And like,
this is not like a Christian mythology. That is like an Italian writer fictional
it's very,
book based on characters.
And if I was still
it's
a YouTuber.
Christian fan fiction, you know.
Right.
If I was still a YouTuber, I would say like, I did talk about it. Why don't you watch this again and share it with all your friends who love that game?
It's a good strategy.
See what I'm talking about.
Did you talk about Deus Ex Invisible War? Because that is totally just about Book of Revelations, and you find out like, oh, J.C. Denton, get it? Jesus Christ Denton?
I don't know that religion is a great premise for a video game, because most video games involve a lot of combat.
You're just going to piss people off. It's true. Like, there's no winning situation in that. Never
have I felt like moved spiritually by any of this stuff, and it's always, I love how much it seeps into the Japanese stuff when it's like they have plenty of spiritualism, but they're fascinated by religions they don't practice or care about.
Well, it's, you know, there's like three main religions that are popular in Japan, and like nobody's really, very few people are like that devoted to any one of them.
You like find a church. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. And sadly, my main memory of El Shaddai, other than like a couple of people, like, this is pretty insane. It's worth checking out.
Yeah.
Is maybe how I personally failed games journalism. Just, I forget what had happened. We were in San Diego Comic-Con, and like, hey, is anybody going to this El Shaddai party? And I'm kind of getting like, nope. El Shaddai release party and whatever. I'm low on the totem pole.
Like at the El Shaddai party. Like, what is that
now,
party even?
Hold on. This is where it gets fun. I don't have a ton of invites for much at this point. So like I'm going. It's the earliest party. It's an open bar. I have, to my discredit, I never looked at, played, or wrote about the game ever. But when I got there, like, none of my colleagues were there. It was just all celebrities. And I was just like, to one of my friends, are you sure you don't want to come to the El Shaddai party or with me and Doug Benson? I have it a selfie. And that was, I think that was when I went outside and, like, I'm having a cigarette with a guy. I've told the story a billion times. It wasn't the same party. It was the same building. Smoking with one guy, he's like, hey, man, how's your Comic-Con? He's like, it's all right. And like, oh, are you working? And he's like, yeah. I don't know. You see anything interesting? He's like, well, what do you mean? Like, oh, you're not press? He's like, no. I'm working. I'm here with Warner Brothers. And like, oh, what thing? He's like, I'm an actor. I'm like, oh, I know you. You're Moist from Dr. Horrible. Oh, holy shit. Yeah. Holy shit. Like, what are you here with?
The most game journalist looking actor.
Yes, he looked me. Yes.
I mean, yeah.
And he's like, what are you here promoting? He's like, Big Bang Theory. I'm like, I don't know it. Probably, look, my advice, it probably sucks and you'll never make a dime.
Yeah.
Quit Big Bang Theory. I definitely did. I want to be the most wrong person ever. I want to be written about in his biography by telling him, you got to quit that Big Bang Theory show and make a Moist cartoon deal.
Yeah.
And then you turn to your friends and said, I'd like to introduce you to my friends Baz and Inga. Please meet Moist.
Don't know who that is.
Bazinga, bro! That's the scene. Oh,
yeah, that's the coincidental moment in the biography movie where the
In my defense, that show was kind of popular, but not stratospherically popular at that point. But it was perfect to bring to Comic-Con because they didn't bring a ton of sitcoms to Comic-Con.
Well, that's the one you're gonna bring. That's that makes sense.
All right, we should move on from El Shaddai to
number three.
Your mother is afraid of you, and your father looks at you with shame in his eyes.
Zim!
Come to Whispering Rock Psychic Summer Camp, and you can show them all. Back home, your powers make you a loner, an outcast, a circus freak.
Rebel.
But in this dojo, in this psychic dojo, they make you a hero.
I don't know how this guy met my parents, but...
Well, it was probably at summer school, because that is the nerd from summer school doing the voice right there.
Oh, yeah.
It's Invader Zim himself. This is Psychonauts. This is the game everyone thinks of when you think of, like, what are we calling this list again? Like,
Beautiful flops. Like, yes, I mean, super inventive, beloved by critics, has an 88 on Metacritic. Sold less than 100,000 copies at launch.
Wow! Was it that low?
Majesco did not even ship 100,000.
I'm part of the reason why. So whose fault is it, really?
Marketing?
I mean, it certainly wasn't the press. This thing was a critical darling. It got hyped up so much before launch. I don't know why this failed. Because everyone who plays it's like, they love it. They love the level design. Mm-hmm. It's charming as fuck.
I didn't play it until right before the second one. And, like, it has datedness to it. But it is a solid platformer and constantly entertaining. And almost very little repetition.
Well, yeah, I mean, all the levels are, they have unique mechanics all the way through the end. And, like, it almost, so, like, I love Double Fine stuff. But it reminded me a little bit of, like, I remember back when DVD commentaries were a big thing, Kevin Smith used to be like, look, I kind of have a built-in audience, but I also sort of come with a threshold, like, to the top my movies will ever attain. It's just kind of like, the studios know.
I think he said, like, I'm the $11 million boy.
Yeah.
Give me $2 million, I'll make you 11.
And that's, this game kind of, like, showed me, like, that's sort of Double Fine. Like, they had these fans that go from game to game. But for some reason, their games also sort of just had this cap. And I think it was, you know, there's just a level of weirdness to all their games, which I love, but isn't for everybody. But I don't know, because this thing, I mean, if anything, maybe this should have been a warning sign to us of, like, the changing media landscape and the importance of games journalism. Because had the games journalologists been listened to, everyone would have bought and played this game. And
I mean, if they could have, who knows if maybe there was a... You know, Majesco's only shipping 100,000. Maybe that's an interesting tale to the story. Like, maybe pre-orders weren't there, or Majesco was a very tiny company at this point.
It was also an Xbox exclusive, wasn't it, at the time?
I think it was multi-platform.
Yeah.
But I remembered it mainly for Xbox, so you might
I think it might have been exclusive
at first. But yeah, Tim Schafer has said that apparently by 2012, it had sold around 400,000 copies. So that's somewhat better.
Somewhat. But not something that's going to get you funding for another game. And I think
not for a game that had by that time attained cult status of like, hey, this is a game you really should play. That's what.
And I think if I'm being really honest with myself, one, I wasn't super knowledgeable about Double Fine's pedigree by the time Psychonauts came out. They were primarily PC adventure games, which I find cloying and boring and survived a lot better when we didn't have the internet.
Full Throttle was good, bro.
I don't disagree.
That was when they were still LucasArts.
That's true.
But yeah. they were a big PC audience, and I'm not sure what their launch schedule was day and date like with PC. People who may have cared about it the most might not have had access. We weren't in a big download area at this point. People having to go into Walmart to find missing cardboard copies of Psychonauts for their PCs might have been disappointed. But also, like, even as much as I love Psychonauts 2, Double Fine's really good in shorter bursts than...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter because, like, the public didn't know that yet either. They just didn't buy it. There was something about it, and I could never tell you what that is in a million years. Because, well, one, if you remember, we were mostly in a print world when this happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's 2005, so...
Screenshots may not have done it justice, because once you see it, like... Psychonauts looks really cool.
Yeah, if you're looking at screenshots, like, this was sort of an era of, like, we're trying to do... to start doing, like, more photorealistic AAA games, and this is a very cartoony-looking game that could... some might have seen it as, like, a throwback to the N64 era.
It was trying to do something intentionally surreal, which doesn't show up in, like, tiny magazine screenshots very well.
I am just now rereading... okay, so the history of this game might explain why it didn't do so well. Mm. So the Microsoft thing was, it had to do with the trouble publishing of this game. So Microsoft was originally signed to be their publishing partner.
Right.
They pulled funding because the game was late and wasn't living up to their standards. Mm-hmm. And then they had to end around secure Majesco.
Yeah, right.
But that caused some major issues, which is so ironic now that Microsoft eventually bought Double Fine.
Mm-hmm.
That,
yeah.
Under new leadership. And
after
published
they
the sequel
them so
to this game.
I totally... yeah. But that's another... when it was mostly being written about, it was in print magazines about, this is late. Microsoft's unhappy. Mm-hmm. It is pulling the plug. And it was negative news surrounding a game that's already hard to sell in text and screenshots.
Yeah. But yeah, and it was originally... going to be Xbox exclusive. Then they had to publish it with Majesco, Xbox and PC, and then I guess a PS port came later.
Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. And if you've never played Psychonauts, like, it's nominally a platformer, but then, like, all of the levels are set within the minds of different characters. Mm-hmm. And so each one is wildly different, and, you know, some of the standouts are, of course, the paranoid milkman, where you go into his head and everyone is either a creepy robotic Girl Scout or a secret shadowy spy, like in a trench coat, who's like trying to appear to be something else, for example.
I see that you are grieving.
I am a grieving widow.
I am your sister in grief.
Yes, thank you.
Which I gotta be honest.
I am a sewer maintenance worker. Watch me use a stop sign as a shovel as I pretend to dig through the air.
Going back and playing that level in a post-QAnon world, it's not nearly as entertaining. That level becomes like almost just like a warning sign of like, oh God, we've gone
this
far.
Yes, so many people like this in real life now.
The mainstream Republican Party in some ways echoes a lot of these types of things.
Yeah.
Or at least some certain voices on their side. And,
yeah, you throw in a Hunter Biden level.
There's the level where you get to be a giant kaiju and stomp around in a city inside a lungfish's imagination.
Ah, top of the morning to you, ma'am.
And good day to you, Officer a Lungfish. How are you today?
Oh, damp and happy, can't complain. And what are you and the wee one up to on this lovely day?
Oh, just obeying the law as always. All posted directives followed to the letter.
Ah, good to hear. Not a one of us want any trouble, that's for sure.
Yes, you as the Kaiju Gogalore are going to mess up everybody's peaceful, idyllic day.
Mm-hmm.
Such good voice work.
It really is. Fantastic.
And Michael and I were huge critics of, like, even the games that sold themselves on being funny weren't, and Psychonauts was.
Yeah. One of the few that pulled it off.
No, this was one of those games where, like, because I knew of Tim's work from before, and the reason I can call him by his first name is I've sat next to the man on an airplane. He's a very nice gentleman.
That gives you license. He's your friend.
I've met him a ton of times. Yeah,
he's super cool. I used to run into him at the Whole Foods near Ubisoft's offices because that was near Double Fine.
I've always met him around Dave. He's always where, like, a party Dave brings me to. What the fuck is...
But, like, I just remember, so when I was at Vivendi, we were, like, working with them on Brutal Legend, which eventually kind of got auctioned off and ended up getting published by EA, but I was excited because it's like, no, the studio's really creative. We give them a chance. They make amazing stuff, but again, it sort of has that upper threshold of stuff, right? So, but then they've also made, like, some of my favorite smallish games, like Costume Quest to this day is a classic that I could replay every Halloween. Like,
stacking, I play it every Halloween. So
stacking's great. Stacking's great. Iron Brigade, or what was that? Eventually Trenched is what the original name of that thing was.
Yeah, even Psychonauts 2, it's like, this is amazing, but, like, I'm kind of getting exhausted. I do like a shorter Double Fine game.
Yeah. Psychonauts 2, definitely. I would just tackle that one head at a time. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just going to go do a level. And
I remember having a lot of fun with it, but I don't remember very much of it.
Oh, man. The Beatles music level is amazing.
Here's what I'm attributing its failure to. Just something I looked up on a lark. Psychonauts, it looks really bad in screenshots, as we've gone over.
It looks muddy and
It looks really great in video. And again, I'm hardly the most tech savvy or social media savvy person, but Helldivers, for instance, I loved and played the first Helldivers. I saw that trailer, which is the opening for the game. I'm like, that's kind of funny. And, like, I never really saw any gameplay footage. And it was like social media people, like talking heads, TikTokers. Dude, look at this fucking game. Like, this is insane. Like, oh, what? That's what Sony should have showed me. Shit. This would have looked Psychonauts. I'm just imagining the world TikTokers. No one's talking about this game, but look at it. Listen to this dialogue. It would take 30 seconds to sell you on the beauty of Psychonauts in video. YouTube launches a few weeks before Psychonauts. There was not a mechanism to rapidly share or showcase Psychonauts in video. It was dependent on the print model and what was the internet was doing in 2005.
Yeah, which was, you know, Games Radar when we came on board. Yeah.
Well, maybe, but if you remember, I forget how it worked, but, like, didn't IGN, like, paywall its video at some point? Like, you had to pay extra if you wanted to see fucking video stuff, or
well,
at least...
Back then, videos were, like, postage stamp size. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, the
real player.
Remember how excited we'd be? Oh, they gave us a QuickTime one, and it's huge. Thank God.
So, this is the way I remember this game, because I went back and played it later on, the Steam port. Which looks fine. It's nice.
You know,
I
play the Xbox enhanced version. It looks very good.
Mm-hmm. So this is I've played a lot of games that you could call playable cartoons, right? Like Hi-Fi Rush or whatever. But the feeling I got from this game, nothing came close to eliciting the feeling of watching Nicktoons or something on an afternoon. Like, it has that level of charm to it. And I've never, it's very rare that games have something like that.
But with a Gravity Falls weirdo arc that is worth following.
Good comparison.
Yeah, very, very good. Psychonauts is something you should absolutely experience. And if you have Game Pass on any platform, you're out of excuses, buddy.
Well, and in a world where creativity sometimes is rarely rewarded the way it should be, if you look at Double Fine's oeuvre, they have weird games, but they're nothing if not creative. And it's just more. I wish there was more of that in the games industry, and we probably should be rewarding it with our dollars more to keep companies like that around. And while, I mean, I'm kind of glad now that they got acquired by Microsoft, because what it means is relative stability and security for a company like that. Like, they can be making their things and not have to worry about the next game being a huge hit, otherwise we all lose our jobs, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm still worried, I know it's easy to look up. What's Double Fine working on?
Why are they looking?
I know, what are they doing?
Were they the ones that released, what is it called? The sniper one where you're controlling the bullet.
Children of the Sun?
Yes. Was that Double Fine?
Or no, I don't think so. That was Devolver put that out.
Devolver. Sorry.
Psychonauts is 3 years old, and where are my dogs at? What's going on?
I mean, that was a studio that before that, they were funding their stuff on Kickstarter.
Kickstarter. Mm-hmm.
They, remember they had their own platform.
Yes. Fig?
Fig. Yes.
Oh, God. Fig.
Where people got equity in the games they would invest
right.
in.
Right. Man.
Interesting. Now you can learn what it's like to suffer with other publishers.
They also the made one of the best Kinect games out there.
The Sesame Street one?
The Sesame Street game.
Oh, yeah.
Eight is great.
All right.
That's what it scored, and blah, 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 blah.
I still have that VR Psychonauts game I need to play.
The Rhombus of Ruin.
Yeah, yeah,
which
yeah.
I think it plays a role in the plot of Psychonauts, too. It gets referenced.
I know my memory, like, you know, my position on Psychonauts is skewed, but, Day of the Devs, is that something Double Fine helped start?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Like, we would go to that thing, and there would be piles of Psychonauts merchandise, pre-Psychonauts 2 announcement, and people would be buying it in droves. You'd see it attached to people's backpacks around the whole festival. It was like the biggest IP at this indie booth. I don't know. I feel like this... I hope it's not the end of Psychonauts.
I mean, the good news there is that shows you how influential this type of game is.
Sure.
You know, like mm-hmm. it's affecting tons of indies. And you can see traces of that when you play certain indie games. You know? Yeah.
This game is the antithesis of indie.
Number two.
Are you all right, Pilot?
I think so. Wait, did you just call me Pilot?
Yes. The late Captain Lastimosa gave you the provisional rank of acting pilot. Congratulations on your promotion. You may call me BT.
BT. Got it.
All right. I know you guys know what this is. I saw a bunch of nods of recognition.
I do, because I'm still playing through this via Game Pass, where it's available for nothing.
Yeah, and I'm surprised you're still playing through it, because it's not that long of a campaign.
Yeah, but it's also like, you know, due to the nature of what we do, like, there's always a game I'm addicted to, and there's a couple games I got to play for work. And this, the way these missions are structured, like, oh, if I want to just disappear for 2 hours into Titanfall 2, I can absolutely do that. And this is, again, kind of a mystifying failure. I think I have a theory on what went wrong here.
Okay.
Because I was one of the people, I loved Titanfall 1. Mm-hmm. I thought it was great. And I was not in the position to be like, I love live service games. And I think, but most of the criticism of Titanfall 1, there's no campaign. What's a fucking respawn, Infinity Ward respawn is the people from Infinity Ward. What is an Infinity Ward game without a campaign, a single player campaign? And They had something piecemeal, which was just like talking heads and a Sega CD TV. Like,
yeah,
you're doing really well against these bots on a multiplayer level that were pretending a story. Mm-hmm. But if you joined a multiplayer level, you'd be having a lot more fun. Why don't you do that, soldier? But it didn't have any kind of campaign. And this, the answer to that major criticism, which I think was overblown, let's say. Mm. But, you know, sometimes that's where gamers are. We don't like... People had kind of made their decision on like something like Suicide Squad before it came out. Like, because that's totally, gamers are welcome to do that. And maybe they were right about Suicide Squad. But I think they made that decision about Titanfall before they played it. The Xbox exclusivity did not help.
Well, that was just for the first game. Titanfall.
It was, but like that's a bunch of people who have nothing to care about going into two. And there wasn't a Game Pass around to like, maybe you could have tried this. There weren't significant sales to play the $60 game, because Titanfall 1 is amazing. It was an amazing multiplayer game, and I've never played the multiplayer in 2 because the story and campaign is fucking captivating. Mm. I'm sure the multiplayer's fine.
Yeah, well, I think...
it's fun.
Reading about it cursorily on Wikipedia, like I think there's an excellent reason why I didn't do so great. So... To start with, it did pretty well by most measurements. It sold around 4 million units, which
that's really good.
That's great. That is great. However, yeah. EA had projected that it would sell about 9 to 10 million units.
This is what I was talking about.
And they were warned by analysts who said, "You are releasing this game in October. between Battlefield 1 and Call of Duty Infinite Warfare.
Mm-hmm. Their own game. Their own fucking game.
And they said, well, we don't think that the user base will for Battlefield 1 will overlap with Titanfall 2.
Now
and
hold
also
on.
We're
both
deciding
press
to
releases,
apparently ignore that Call of Duty exists.
Both, all those press releases offer, if I'm not mistaken, thousands of hours of gameplay. Mm-hmm. You don't think there's an overlap in releasing the... What? You want 1,000 hours to be played in a game released within a week of your other game that promises 1,000 hours of multiplayer gameplay? Ugh, eat my butt. Eat my butt. Because whatever that Battlefield game was, what do you remember what it was, Michael?
It was Battlefield 1. It was the World War 1 one.
Okay, people do like that. Like, we were playing something right before Helldivers, my friends, and a buddy we hadn't seen in 10 years jumped in our party chat. What's going on, guys? It's Mike. Mike, it's so good to see you. What are you doing? Like, I can't get over Battlefield 1. This is like 6 months ago. He's still playing Battlefield 1. So it's got its fans.
I remember I was working for Scuf Gaming when this game came out, and that was the thing. It was, everything was geared towards the new Call of Duty and Battlefield 1. And I remember going, you know, guys, the second Titanfall's coming out, and everyone looked at me like I'd grown a second hand. And they're like,
what?
And I was already, I already had a reputation as the guy who liked indie games. So never mind that it was Titanfall 2. They still were like, okay, weirdo, we're going to be over here worried about COD.
That's what I think is the biggest tragedy. Titanfall 1, gamers complained, Xbox exclusivity, no campaign. The next game is the opposite. We heard you. But it's kind of too late. The association with your brand hurting gamers' feelings is already there. And what are you supposed to do?
Yeah, but yeah, we'll give you a great campaign, a wonderful, memorable campaign where, like, partway through you get a wristband that switches you between eras in time, and so you're exploring this facility, like, in when it's ruined in the present and when it's populated in the past and people are trying to kill you. You get to hear borderline not quite wisecracks from your giant robot friend.
BT, I found Anderson. He's in the ceiling.
Objective complete. We have rendezvoused with Major Anderson.
That's cold, BT.
Correct. Anderson's current temperature is 17 degrees Celsius, below the threshold of human survival.
Correct.
We have approached the planet Ligma.
Yeah, there's that bit where you're like on a bunch of speeding spaceships and he like winds up and throws you from one to another.
BT, we need a fastball.
Copy that, 6-4. You can do this, Cooper.
Just like before.
Not exactly. There are significantly more variables to throwing between two moving platforms. Good luck.
Anyway, try not to die.
I'm frustrated that at no point he didn't look at his suit and went, toss me. You have to toss me. Don't tell the elf.
That would have been right in place. Yes.
And that, I think that's the real tragedy of this. What people, the game was marred for lacking that Infinity Ward campaign, and you got that. And I'm one of the people who ignored it. I did not play Titanfall 2 until almost 10 years on. But that's why it's so fucking tragic. This is an Infinity Ward level. This is a different kind of campaign. It's a very well-made campaign. Mm-hmm. Nobody cared.
I'd say it's better than a lot of Call of Duty campaigns because, like, even at their best, a lot of those are basically, like, dark rides. You know, they're just very, very well-crafted experiences where you're going through a tube and shooting at enemies. And this one,
great,
like,
great
at
memorable
of,
moments, but not character development. Where this did have,
this had character development. This had, you know, more freedom of movement, more exploration. It felt less like I'm just being funneled through a really exciting firefight.
Mm-hmm.
So. It made me care about a freaking robot.
Yeah,
and he's closed.
Yeah, made him a real relatable character who was cool to hang out with, and you felt for toward the end of the game.
Absolutely.
But
and then it gave you that fucking sweet handgun at the end of the game. Yeah. That handgun was badass, man.
Is that the pilot gun that just like zeroes in on, you know, does automatic headshots every time?
They reward you for getting through the campaign by being like, here's your power fantasy moment. Yeah. Kill everybody.
Enjoy.
Yeah. Nice. All right. Well, speaking of power fantasies, how'd you like to be a god? You recognize Amaterasu. It, son. Yes. So this game, of course, is Okami. Which I only learned recently is a pun that it means both wolf and god. Like, great deity. Depending on how you write it out. But Okami is the
Japanese
word for wolf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, though. This game is another... If the beauty of showcasing video... And the game had trailers and all mm-hmm. that. But there's so many beautiful moments that you have to... You would have to watch a bunch of Let's Plays. And this game wasn't HD initially, remember?
That's
so,
right.
Like, they didn't PS2. Look great. This game might have the slowest fucking start of any game I've ever loved.
Incredibly slow.
So, like, if this was still back in the day where there were blockbusters. You could rent games. I can see people feeling like, what the fuck is this? Mm-hmm. Like, when do I start playing this?
I don't want to play.
I've got a weekend with this thing.
Yeah. Yes. It is slower than Zelda. It's a Zelda-like, but slower than Zelda to get going. And
I saw that play out. So I was around the industry at the time and at a lot of industry events. They took this fucking game to everything. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem is, Chris, like you said, it takes a while to get going.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of, like, it's not a learning curve, like, because it's difficult. It's just, like, there's a lot of mechanics. There's slow roll introducing you to, and it just is, like, this isn't a great short demo game.
The game's main feature is stopping the gameplay to draw on the screen.
Yes.
So that you can, you know, you make a slash here, and it's like, oh, they just got slashed by a sword.
It was a Wii gimmick game. It had a Wii gimmick.
And for elongated cutscenes with fucking everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody has a fucking novel to tell to you in the beginning of the game.
And it all sounds like this. Huh?
Yeah, wait, why do we like this game so much?
I'm not kidding. I bought this game four times.
I own this
four different platforms.
As well.
And every time I load it up, I'm like, why do we like this? Oh, it takes 20 hours to start.
I wouldn't go that far, but
I know it's not that much. But
this is the only game on the list I don't own.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Like Okami HD, like I forget exactly. I think that was a PS.
I mean, you're in good company because this game only sold 270,000 copies as of 2007. It has a Metacritic of 93. It is the highest rated game on our list. By 2023, it's estimated to have sold around 4 million copies.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
yeah. I mean, I was
good
told
Switch version.
Most
now,
people still don't own it.
I was told personally, and I'm not going to tell you who or how I know this. Once it was ported to the Wii, the game made money right after that. Like, it was just on the PS2, because I think maybe more people bought it on the Wii. Because, paintbrush controls, that seems perfect. For my glorified D-pad, that's all the Wiimote was initially. Like, it can point it left, it'll do a left thing. Point it right, it will not do a 1-1 motion. You're not doing anything. It's a very, very shitty controller. But, like, it was a very early critical darling that people knew that they missed, that they could buy. It wasn't cheaper. And, they could buy it on the Wii when the Wii didn't have a lot of... What would you call it? Core games going for it?
Yeah. Wait, is this the one, though, that for the Wii port, it used the IGN watermarks?
Yes. I hate that I know the guy who did that, and I totally understand.
Look, but it's right there.
Person who
it.
Did that.
Yeah. As a man who works on Sonic the Hedgehog titles for a living... I never take anything off the internet and present that in an official capacity because there's so much fan stuff out there, etc.
Well, I'll only say in this hypothetical person's defense, if they were supplied with the art, this might not have happened. Mm. If there was approvals on the art, this also might. There's a lot of other people who should be in trouble than the person who did this.
It's similar to a story when I was working on the Guitar Hero games. There may or may not have been a piece of box art that may or may not have included a misspelling of one of the band names that fortunately was caught in time, but at a time where I think it cost a lot of money to
fix
that.
Yeah,
Yeah, it's just one. But I, you know, I've worked in those situations. It's a smaller team than you're imagining. It looks fine. I have so much other stuff to do. Oh my god! Oh my god! The box? Who cares?
Like, nobody's going to look at that once they put it in the console.
You heard him. He said it was fine. It's Brett. It was Brett. Brett did it. Fucking Brett.
No, it's him. No, that's it's fine.
No, nobody. Yeah, nobody I know was there. Nobody you know was there at the time. But yeah.
Wait,
Okami's
the only
one on this list that's like, it is not instantly a masterpiece, so I don't know if there was ever a demo, but I bet it sucks.
It doesn't demo well. Real quick aside, I know the listeners will appreciate this. Brett Elston, who I don't think you could ever envision hearing anyone say this, who I was comparing bench press totals with the other day, like literally talking exercise. Yes. Yeah. Did you have that on your 2024 bingo card?
No.
Matt Allen and Brett Elston comparing bench press.
Knowing Brett now, yes. But like, but it makes... But as far
and
as...
protein intake, by the way. We were comparing how many grams of protein we're
is he trying to get
Christ.
Skinnier? Fuck him. I'm tired of his goddamn 20-year-old body.
I think he's trying to bulk up. I think he's trying to get the opposite.
But Okami is wonderful. And it is the only game on this list, I think, that doesn't do itself any favors for its pacing. It feels old. Oh, you know, this is a really...
It is old. It's a 2006 game.
Well, here's something I posit. What's the difference between it and, for example, like Persona 5, which came out and was like the darling of everybody? Everyone fucking played that game. Everyone loved that game. And it took 900 years to get started.
First of all... How dare you, Sega player. Second of all, sort of not true, because remember, Persona 5 does start with the escape sequence, which is sort of like one of those Power Fantasy tutorial things where it's like, hey, we're going to show you.
Yeah. Okami doesn't do that, and I'm telling you, every time I fire it up, I'm like, fuck, I forget this awful tutorial
Okami
portion.
Starts out with first a bunch of cutscenes explaining the backstory, then, there's a lot of... wandering around in this benighted landscape and just sort of getting into... I think you get into a few fights early on, and then you learn like, oh, I can make the sun come up, and now all the people are here, and now I'm going to wander around and talk to them for a while. And it's going to take a while for the adventure to really pick up.
I'm going
up
to accomplish
going.
A shitload of mundane tasks before I can play the game, so I know why the game is important. And that is hubris on the developer's part, and like I actually wish that could be shortened. But again, like in a TikTok-y world, it's really easy to showcase incredible moments from this game that look good to this day that happen later on. And I had a minor push that I made for it when the HD version came out. I was like, if it's possible, do you think we can let's try and own Earth Day for Okami. Like make it like an Earth Day game, because there's not a lot of games, you know, we've done top fives before about like you are revitalizing the world. And those moments when that happens, it's always beautiful and endorphin fuel.
And then it does that cool Princess Mononoke thing where like flowers spring up everywhere your character steps. And I feel like we should say something about what the game is at this point. We've kind of been hammering on how long it takes to get started, but like, this is a game where you play as a magical wolf who is also Amaterasu, the sun goddess, one of the most important gods in Shinto, and according to tradition, who the emperors of Japan are descended from. And you partner with a little beetle named Isun, who's an artist, and so... on the one hand, like, this is a Zelda-style exploration slash hack-and-slash game, but you also have this ability to freeze the action, turn it into, like, a 2D painting, and then draw on it with this paintbrush that exists sort of outside of the world, And that's how you do, like, you can draw the sun and make the sun come up, or by drawing a circle, or you can just draw lines and you'll slash your enemies with a magic sword that's always with you, in addition to your regular wolf attacks. It's just a really big, expansive, very long adventure, and it's absolutely worth diving into.
And to the credit of the original team, Platinum, like, it looks cool the more up-resed it gets. It always looks beautiful because the original design choices.
Yeah, it's like a cross between cell shading and like a painterly look.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They were doing the brush thing before Street Fighter 4.
Yes.
I just remember like playing this on PS2, it's taking forever to start, and just like it's like looking at it through a screen door. It's just like through a heavy fog. It doesn't look good. And it took two generations for that game to look the way I think is most palatable. So I understand people's trepidation in jumping into it, but it's always available for $20 or less. It really is one of the best games ever.
Yeah, it's always on sale.
It's $10 on Steam right now.
Oh, perfect.
There you go. There you go. I also think they did recoup a little bit of their investment, because let's be honest, the handheld game, which was a new game, not a port.
Yeah. Kamiden?
Heavily borrowed assets from the original game. It was basically like, yeah, let's take all this stuff we already created and put this in a new game.
Yeah. A two game strong series.
Yeah. And one was just exclusive to the original DS.
But I lose my mind whenever I think about those Marvel vs. Capcom cinematic trailers were just like beautiful Joe is carrying Amaterasu around. It's just wonderful. Love it.
All right. So that has been our top five beautiful flops, games that were critical darlings, commercial failures.
Who will pay me the most for Okami hoodies, which I have a ton of?
Oh,
I will. I will pay you the most.
No. I can't gouge Michael. I've already done that enough. Yeah, I was like, and I have not only the hoodies, but the prototypes of the hoodies, which I like more. I have those sitting in a box somewhere around here. The things you steal from your employer. Oh, my.
I mean,
it fell off the truck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. All right. Well, that has been our top five. Yes, et cetera, et cetera. Hope you enjoyed it. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a bunch of new releases, some news, some other stuff. So stay tuned. Even though we ain't got money, I'm so in love with your honey. Everything will bring a chain of love. In the morning when I arise, bring a tear of joy to my eyes and tell me everything's gonna be alright. Let's get scratching. Would you like exclusive bonus podcast commentaries and more from the LaserTime crew? Then we strongly encourage you to support this show on patreon.com/lasertime. It supports not only this show, but all the rest of the LaserTime Network. You'll get commentaries, play games with the hosts, see exclusive videos first, and receive an uncut weekly ad-free podcast bonus time. Speaking of which, here's a quick taste.
We are going to be talking about the film from 1984 that I've watched the most number of times.
Oh,
no other film in 1984 have I watched and rewatched as many times as this film.
Not even Paris, Texas?
Not even Barton Fink?
Nope.
I think I'm sort of with you on this, because it's just one of my earliest memories. And I think, given our ages, 1984, I'm not asking to watch any movie. I don't know any movies exist, really. I have to be brought to one, or it has to be shown to me. And I think I have really specific memories of this was just brought to school.
Yeah.
I would have been 4 when the movie came out, so I think there's no way I'm in the theater, because it's Neverending Story is not a huge hit.
Yeah, listeners, we are talking about the 1984 film, The Neverending Story.
Get Bonus Time, a weekly, uncensored, and commercial-free podcast every Tuesday, starting for just $5 on patreon.com/lasertime.
And welcome back to our second segment, where before we begin talking about new releases, I found something that we were talking about earlier. I feel like I still owe these people a plug. Midnight Arcade, Play Your Way Book by Penguin, which has excellent Ernesto Cousins 3 and WrestleVania both of which are fantastic titles for Choose Your Own Adventure stuff. Anyway, that is our longest lead into. I'm sure it's not even our longest lead in. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. So, Endless Ocean Luminous came out on Switch. I played it and for a bit, and then I immediately went and saw, like, is this a remaster or a remake? Because I don't know how to describe it. Even though it's HD, it looks and feels like a Wii game. The UI is very much like, yeah, this is what UI looked like on Wii games.
I remember the game was fondly remembered, like the original Endless Ocean.
Yeah.
I mean, it delivered on its promise.
Yeah.
It's like the non-violent mode in Assassin's Creed where you can just be a tourist and look at stuff and have it tell you about it,
Kind of. You swim around, you scan fish, and then like, uh-oh, a large predator is about, you'd better hide from it. It could be dangerous. Well, maybe we'll see it later. The danger has passed. Let's go report and hunt for treasure and bring it back to HQ. And it's like this whole thing about like, oh, there's this ancient people known as the Ioannis who disappeared tens of thousands of years ago, but you found a stone slab, and I bet this will be important to the plot.
And this all sounds like the setup for a theme park ride. pre-show bespoke video in a theme park. Mm-hmm. Like,
I'm looking at screen caps, and I'm seeing one that appears to have a Loch Ness monster in it, which might be the thing that actually makes me buy this game.
Yeah. Do you like all? Do you want an open world Pokemon Snap with public domain IP? Endless Ocean.
Apparently, like the landscape shifts around. It's not quite roguelite, but there's a bunch of randomized stuff that happens later on. Going by IGN's review of it, IGN, by the way, did not like it very much. But
it's not much of a game.
Yeah, it's a scuba diving, picture taking, treasure hunting sim.
Mm-hmm.
Don't expect to fight sharks.
Dave the Diver, this ain't.
No, go play Dave the Diver. El Shaddai also came out HD remaster on Switch. I played a bunch of the HD remaster. Like, it seems to be the same remaster that came out on PC 3 years ago. But it's on Switch now. And so, it's like we were talking about it right in the first segment, it has a very unique aesthetic. It's a pretty fun character action game. Feels like, you know, Devil May Cry, but with pared down action. You steal your three weapons from other characters, and it's neat. It has a neat storyline.
Let me ask you this. Is the remake or remaster more or less Shaddai than the original?
It's exactly as much Shaddai.
Los Shaddai.
Los Shaddais. El Shaddai. Anyway. It's also continuing the religious theme. Indica.
Take it every night, bro.
Yeah, I bet you do.
No, dude.
Is a very, very strange game.
I like this character. Who is this? Let me introduce. Who are we talking to here?
Tell me about this guy.
I want to know more about this guy.
I remember I had a friend who made fake IDs for a living.
For a living?
Yeah, and he, like, the guy's, he's like, I'll pay you more, but I want to be Steve Stativa, who lives at 420 High Road.
Shut up.
Indica, California, and he's like, I'm not fucking doing that.
Right there, dude. But why would you go Indica? That's a real city name, by the way.
You want to be arrested? Come on.
Right. Come on, like, dude. This is just, these are supposed to, like, not flag anything.
Right.
Idiot.
That's like getting a fake ID with just the name McLovin on it at this point. Like, okay, people get the joke, but don't do that.
Yeah. No.
Which, by the way, my friend, like, we're so old, like, it was just the first guy with, like, Adobe Photoshop 1 or 2 when they still had laminated driver's license. It was so easy. There wasn't even, like, the foil or the weird stamp.
Oh, man. Yeah,
with no scanner.
What is Indica?
Indica, it's an adventure game about.
It's like more heady and more, sleepy. Sure. You want to do it. am I reversing them somehow? I really perfected this character. I don't know, man. I'm not doing too well. Someone stole the bee and I couldn't disc golf all day. So, like, I.
Uh
Yeah,
you're quoting PCU now.
No. I'm actually I'm a frother. I like froth.
When were you a part of the Groundlings?
I think due to the two sentences of improv I can get out per character, never.
So Indica, the game.
Yes,
It's about a nun in an alternate history, 19th century Russia. Who has these weird visions and who has an internal monologue who may actually be Satan. Is constantly awesome. Just telling her to you shouldn't do it, but there's this thing that will make your job easier, but it's forbidden. And you shouldn't go over there, and that would be bad. She wouldn't want to do that. No, so it's the story you tell yourself of then Michael went over and did this thing, if you have that sort of internal monologue, but it's
another game for blasphemers.
Yeah, it's both narrating the game, and it's also clearly her internal monologue, but it also appears to be Satan. But I mean, it's interesting that everyone seems to hate her. She's a young novice nun. All the other nuns don't want to talk to her. Some of the stuff you have to do at the very beginning is super tedious. Because you have to, you're told, okay, go to the warehouse and get this basket to bring to this other nun. And so you have to, you don't have your sprint unlocked yet. You have to walk through the convent grounds.
Nun sprint.
You go down through this building. You find your way to a warehouse. You pick up
If you play on Sunday, Tom Selleck will shoot you.
Uh-huh. You pick up this sack of potatoes.
You have to earn the flying ability to become the flying nun. Yeah. I get it.
I'm trying to relate this very boring thing. So you take the sack of potatoes to the old nun. She says, go fill up that barrel with water. So she gives you a bucket. And then you slowly walk to the well that's, about 50 feet away. And then you fill up a bucket. You have to lower the winch and, raise it back up again. And then you take it over to the barrel. And then a little happy digital readout says, 1 out of 5. It's I have to do this 4 more times, and so you do it again, and then the devil in your head says, there's this holy water pump that's closer to the barrel that you could use to, it's forbidden, but it's okay to drink. Why is it a sin to use it to make soup? Just go, use that maybe. And I was now I have to do this because I'm virtuous. I will resist the temptation. And so you go and you fill up this stupid barrel. And then it's finally done, and another nun comes out and just dumps it over. And this is all pointless.
Chris, may I, as the sole person here recording wearing a Thomas Magnum Hawaiian shirt, may I allow me to say, nuns don't podcast on Sunday.
They don't.
When I just blew Michael away.
They don't, but how Catholic are you Catholic, Matt?
I am.
Were you born Catholic?
Well, this is an Eastern Orthodox nun, so.
Nuns are the scariest people I've ever met. And
terrifying.
My father went to Catholic schools, and he even said, I got hit by so many nuns, just seeing one, must move away. Yeah. And just, nuns still scared. Yeah. It's not a bad character to help Setsuna's whatever that game is.
It's giving Senua's, what is this?
Yeah, there you go. Senua's sacrifice. It does feel a bit like that, but. So you're sent out of the convent to deliver a letter pretty early on, and you start to find weird stuff. You've passed the wreckage of a train, and this guy's been impaled, and there's a musician standing there singing a song to him, and a doctor says this guy doesn't have a chance, and his last wish is just to hear this song, so don't interrupt. A bunch of convicts who were on this train crashed it so that they could escape, and this guy died. And then you find your way into a village, and content warning, have to interrupt a sexual assault in progress. And then you meet this soldier with a gangrenous arm who takes you hostage. And there's this comical sequence where there's a soldier who stutters and can't shoot straight. And he's trying to convince the guy who's taking you hostage to put down his gun. And he just starts stammering his way through a sentence. And the nun who has a gun pointed at her starts finishing his sentences for him. And then there's this very slow chase sequence where he awkwardly runs after you and is shooting and can't hit anything. And you're on a motorbike anyway. It's bizarre.
Meshes so well with Catholicism in general.
It's Eastern Orthodoxy, yeah, no. I'm telling you. Stop. But also, there's like a strange thing where, like, every once in a while something will go really wrong for you, and the world will literally shatter, and, like, red light is pouring through all the gaps in the world, and the devil is taunting you, just going on an extended monologue, and you can, like, hit a button to start praying, and then everything goes back to normal. But it's a puzzle-solving mechanic, because, like, okay, if I get everything back to normal and I walk over here and then I let go, this platform I'm standing on will move to the other side of the room, and then I can access this other platform, and so I can get to wherever it is I'm supposed to go by praying or listening to the devil.
Jesus Christ!
Is the praying like a taunt? Is the praying like a taunt mechanic?
No, it's almost like you're holding the world in. Like, you hold down the left trigger, and she just starts muttering a prayer, and everything goes back to normal for as long as she's muttering.
Mm. I might have to get this game.
It is kind of amazing. I'm impressed by it so far. Insane. I want to play more.
I did want to. Do you like it?
I do like it.
All right.
Wow. Yeah.
All right.
That's wild. Okay.
I'm just sort of describing what happens in the first 15 minutes or so. But. Yeah,
how long have we been podcasting? I've never done a Mikey likes it joke before now.
Yeah.
Like, wow.
Am I in fifth grade again? Is that what everybody's saying to me every other day? Come on.
I should have told him, Michael hates that. I learned that like the first week I met him. Don't call him Mikey.
It's a cereal commercial.
I'm aware of life.
It's a cereal commercial from before any of us were born. Why do we have this knowledge?
I was around.
No, it's like the 70s. You weren't around in the
70s. Because they kept referencing it in 90s. Shit with the Tiny Toons and stuff like that.
Couple other
Stella
things.
Stella Blade.
Stella Blade. The game that somehow became part of a culture war, which is a shame because it's a lot of fun.
Not for me. I played the demo. It was fun.
You said you played it. The more you played, the more you liked,
yes,
right?
Yes, I did. The demo, I'll be honest, did not impress me very much. It felt very linear, and the swordplay felt kind of basic. But the longer you keep playing, the more it opens up, and the more you get used to kind of the rhythms of, like, parrying stuff. fighting your way through increasingly elaborate monsters, and the blatant sexualization is there, but it's like Nier Automata, where it just sort of, like, you notice it, and then it just sort of fades into the background after a while, and like, okay, you know, I got a new outfit. I'll look at that for a while. All right, now I'm just back to focusing on the swordplay and the action.
I'd like to fade into her background. Am I right?
The point is, I'm scoring this game triple D for titties with three
guys.
Weeks.
I think what's important to recognize with this is that it is the most sexually explicit game that exists because of non-censorship, and there are no games out there that are more on our side.
Yes, our side. Yeah. Except it's been censored, and we should remove it from sale immediately.
Let's be mad now. Yeah. You're right. It's been five minutes.
Nah, not about anything. And also, I just want to say, porn games exist.
Oh, my God.
Throw that out there.
There's a setting in Steam. You have to tell it not to show you the porn games.
Dude, I need to check that setting because I'll just be idly going through a discovery thing just to pass the time. And I'm like, I'm not a prude, and this is shocking.
Yeah. Like a Catholic school ball drainers. Puzzle game. I love it. I love it.
It's a match three. Come on.
Match two. It's even easier.
Honey Pop was one of my games of the year when it came out, so I'm not afraid of
I've heard
this
a lot
shit.
Of fandom about Honey Pop.
Isn't that a whole genre now? Or is it there's several of those games?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a bunch of them. And it's fun. It's fun, it's dirty, and that kind of thing. And I don't know. This game looks fine. It looks great.
It looks, like, visually, it's really stunning.
It's beautiful.
It looks beautiful. If you like Nier Automata, this feels a lot like almost an unofficial sequel. A lot of it feels like an homage to Nier Automata, that, like, you're sort of in this post-apocalyptic world. There is a bunch of humans, but they may not be entirely human. They might be cyborgs or robots or something. It's never 100% clear. You're fighting a bunch of mutants within the wreckage of the old world, and you're finding, like, weird relics that you're puzzling over. Like, oh, what are these? Or like, oh, those Those are drink cans. They used to house electrolyte solutions. Well, it's like the big collectible in the game is that you're finding like soda and beer cans. And the main character, just really likes to collect them.
So you know what plants crave.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. But I think they wanted to actually get licensed labels at one point, but they weren't able to get any.
This is totally
sponsors.
A game I'm going to pick up for $30. Mm.
What a random game to throw all of your personality and edgelord bullshit on.
It really is. Like, what is it about this game that makes it such a flashpoint?
Well, I think what's interesting about it is that it is a Japanese influence game from Korea.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Who like, no Western developer would, they probably wouldn't do a couple of things this game did. Mm.
Oh, speaking of things this game did, Michael, can you give us an update on the news story from last week with the graffiti? They've updated it already, right? Like, what does it read now?
It now reads Crime R Shop.
Crimer.
You hear that?
Good change.
Black people can now play this game and never go into their hidey hole.
Good.
Don't.
Yeah. We protected the black people again.
Silliness. Absolutely.
Well, the R Shop is just like, it's just kind of like this creepy lady that keeps hitting on you until you buy information from her. But, and then there's some vending machines. You buy a lot of stuff from vending machines in this.
Can you buy information about her? I don't have the energy to make this joke. I don't have the energy at all.
You pass out halfway through.
Like, what the fuck? Why are people like, I haven't seen anything sexualized in history.
It's
Power Girls comic this week is the horniest cover I've ever seen, and it's from a Warner Brothers Corporation.
I read comic books when I was 13 years old that are more sexualized than this. Mm-hmm. Like, it's such a weird thing to put everything behind.
Blah, blah, blah. Once again, sexualization is okay. I think people's problem was it became the default
for a long time.
Especially in the
early 2000s.
Right. And it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing to like and play these things. And I'm all for like an overly sexualized objectifying game. It just doesn't have to be the norm. Mm-hmm, like if you want to do that intentionally, go for it. Being the norm is stupid.
What was there was a game that was the ad was like some dude with a controller like watching a girl across the street like customizing her with his controller and like ripping her clothes off or something, and then it's like, this is an ad for a racing game. This is about customizing cars.
I don't know if Matt got it in the news, but there's something I want to talk about in the news related to cars.
Go ahead. No, I didn't catch anything car related.
Well, it was just that Sony teamed up with Honda to make, it's called like the Afeela, and it's like a Sony electric Honda with a PlayStation interface.
This is a real car.
It's a real car, but even the person being asked in the interview, like, can I play PlayStation games on the console? And like, I'm pretty sure there's laws about playing games on your speedometer, but we don't know yet. So let's just say no for now. Yeah. But like on the rear seats, like it has that technology exists. Like download your cloud save, pick up your play. You can do it in the rear seats for sure for all your PlayStation games. You can theme. You're like, I selected a theme on the dashboard for Gran Turismo, and now, you know, it's like a Tesla. It's like a big, long, wide screen, and it's Gran Turismo themed. But they are partnering with Sony. Sony kind of has a PlayStation car out there. It is beyond any of our affordability. I don't know where. I love the idea of electric cars, but it's like, it kind of needs to be my second car because I might need to drive more than 100 miles. That's like,
is it too late to bring up the fact that I love doing it in the rear seats?
I was thinking it, so I'm glad you said it.
Yeah. Usually the rear seats are where I put things.
Put things. Yeah.
When I'm sexing,
of course.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yes, I don't like the ear canals. I find the nasal passages leaving something to be desired and make me feel small. to be honest.
And I just don't feel good about myself.
Makes me feel small. Yeah. I don't like my dick being used as a water pick.
Right. Well, Stellar Blade is good. It's growing on me the more I play through it.
Good for you, Stellar Blade.
It's fine.
Why do we all come to the fucking Brando reference at this point? It's
like, right there, because it's right there.
Yeah. Pools also came to Steam last week.
New Pools!
It is I hesitate to just say a weird game. That's not very descriptive. How many of you have heard of The Backrooms? The Backrooms it's like Slenderman. It's an internet urban legend thing that it's a creepypasta, that people have been building onto and building out into a whole world. So the idea is that, like, it's possible to get stuck in a corner or whatever and accidentally noclip through reality, and then you'll wind up in, like, an endless maze of, like, back passages at a convention center or something. And but it has multiple levels, and one of these levels is known as the pool rooms, and it's just, like, an endless series of, like...
Men in beanies talking about libertarian things. That's a Tim Pool reference.
No.
It's good.
Really? I'm talking very fast and very high pitched. I don't know why women don't like me.
Isn't that a Ben Shapiro thing? I don't know.
They're the same guy.
It's all the same.
They just put on a beanie and a mustache.
Just one's in a band. That's all I know.
You heard it here first. So, pools is like it's an endless series of indoor pool spaces with, like, you know, covered in white tile. And very pretty,
I did see this with slides and shit.
Yeah, a bunch of water slides and, like, impossible structures and, like, dark, semi-submerged areas that you have to get through. There are no monsters or anything. It is nominally a horror game in that, like, it's just sort of off-putting to navigate these spaces. The game wants you to feel alone and isolated and very much uncomfortable. For my part, I realized, like, I fucking love this. I'm extremely comfortable. I want to back myself into a dark hallway and just stare out at how the light reflects off the water. This is neat.
There are very few things I've creatively written that I am not embarrassed by. But one of the short stories I think I got published somewhere was about, I'm using air quotes, haunted water park. Because I think that's like, if you've ever... Like, my grandparents lived in Miami, and there were a bunch of water parks there before Hurricane Andrew that were, like, not very well attended. And, like, theme parks, blah, 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 you know, Five Nights at Freddy's, there is tons of horror fodder. Now imagine the constant threat of drowning.
I was just about to say, what this game needs, Chris, is a mod for that abandoned Disney island.
River Country.
Where it's just, like, there's... deadly E. coli, like flesh-eating bacteria and stuff there.
I was there with my lady and her kid, and I'm like, I want to film this.
Oh, there's other people. There's the YouTube videos of dudes who swam out there and got arrested, right?
Like, she's like, we'll get in trouble. I'm like, not if your kid jumps over the thing. And I'd be
stop.
This kid is, what a cut-up. She's constantly messing up. I was just going after her. I'm like, no. Hey, darling, jump over the fence and I'll go after you and I'll pretend they won't arrest you. I'll be like, I will hit the shit out of her later. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I'm so embarrassed. And then I'll wink at her bunch and buy her a big old fucking dinner later. That was the closest I got to, like, invading River Country, because I've stood next to it several times.
Visually, this game kind of looks like PT to me. Like, it's sort of semi-photo real, right?
Yeah, it looks... looks really good, like and because it's only rendering environments, like, yes, it's very close to photorealistic. I will say that, you know, there, it's just because it doesn't have monsters doesn't mean it's not dangerous or that it's boring. The danger comes from accidentally stepping into deep areas. If you go any place where the water goes over your head, you basically instantly die. But rewinds. So it'll just rewind, like, you know, 5 seconds or whatever to put you in a safe space. And, like, if you want to kill yourself over and over again, you can. But
not to over elaborate on the inspiration for my short story about the evil. There was a portion where they dyed the water red to make it seem bloody.
Ooh.
And they were. But, like, it was based on being in weird ass Florida water parks that are all closed now with 101,000 drowning, and like you would walk up like 8 stories of stairs. There's like a guardrail and everything slippery, and I fell several times and caught myself before slipping off over the edge. Like, water parks now are mostly safe, but they had infinite potential to be lethal and horrifying.
They were badass back then.
There was a dome in Six Flags Atlantis where you would swim under an enclosure for like two of the lengths of your body. You would swim through a tube in the kids' area. And I remember a kid like kind of not making it, and some his sister just pulling him out, and like, nobody would know if you drowned in this hole built by fucking adults for children.
And that happened several times a day. Yeah. Like that close call. Mm-hmm. Like,
Jesus.
And who is our protection? 15-year-olds with lifeguard wieners.
And they're stoned.
They don't give a shit.
Not shitting on them. It's just that I don't want them to be the first line of defense. And
I'm shitting on them. Impressive. Fuck them.
just to they finish explaining this game, so the puzzle aspect, like people call it a walking simulator. It's not really a walking simulator. It's a maze simulator. So these levels are very big. They're very open. They're very confusing. And the goal is to find the exit in each one, and the exit is usually hidden past some very dark, dangerous-looking, or deceptive areas.
Weird.
So, yeah,
it's
great.
I don't have any insight, but I
loved it.
I think this is either has been in development for a while, or it's based on a bunch of creepypasta that kind of pre-existed.
No, in the Steam description, it's like, this was inspired by, and it straight up like gives you the sources of stuff.
Well, it's just the liminal spaces, those weird back room things. That's such a big thing right now.
Dude, it's crazy. When you go anywhere behind the scenes at a water park or theme park where you're not supposed to be, it sucks, and there's a very awful vibe to everything.
Yeah. But yeah, level 37 of the back rooms is specifically what this is based off of.
Good idea.
Go look it up. Also, you added Demon Slayer Kimetsu no Yaiba, Sweep the Board. What is this?
Because
Matt?
I work at Sega, and this is a Sega game.
I mean, fantastic.
So, yes, there's your caveat. This is a Sega employee speaking here. But no, this is, what if, and the marketing team would probably kill me for saying this, I don't work on this game, but like, what if Mario Party, but with the Demon Slayer skin, right? So it is like a board game. The reason it's called Sweep the Board is it's like it's like a board game thing where like you play mini games at each stop on the board game to score points and ultimately win. But it has its thing it has that Mario Party doesn't is it has a day night mechanic. And so you're trying to get points and then turn it into the night cycle and hunt down demons at night, because that's when the demons come out.
Why not? Because like it's a genre that is palatable because everybody can play it. And most people wouldn't mind a little horror in their party games.
And I don't know if your kids have heard or not, but the kids love them some Demon Slayer. It's kind of a big deal anime.
I was segueing that like it's the same but opposite of Crab Souls.
Another Which is actually treasures. Called Another Crab's Treasure, but yes.
I know. Crab Souls. I just said that.
okay.
But it... Man, did I want to love this game more than I did? Did you end up playing it, anybody?
I did, yeah, for a bit.
Is it Crabzels?
It's unforgiving, I'll say that.
It's really tough, and, you know, my games journalist criticism is that, like, some of the stuff feels unresponsive and never gets better. Like, why does it take so long to block? Why does it take so long to hit? Why does it take so long to cancel? And then there are, like, Bubsy 3D platforming levels like this just sucks. This is
well,
bad.
Well, now, Chris, remember what they say. One man's trash is another crab's treasure.
That's the greatest thing about the game is that like all your a bunch of your weapons are like discarded bread clips and chip bags.
I love the idea that like you're not trading in souls for experience or for levels. You're purging microplastics from your body are accumulated as you fight other enemies.
So there's an environmental message.
There's a heavy environmental message.
Presentation is really, like, we have not, the one thing we haven't seen in the Souls genre is something funny and colorful. Mm-hmm. And this does all of that, but like, I really feel like needs a major update at some point. Because there's
Again, I'm going to give these ideas away for free. Hey, someone do a SpongeBob mod for this fucking game. That'd
sure.
be dope.
It would fit in very well. Yeah. Fit in very well. Your main enemy is like one of those sharks on a pulley stick thing with a cowboy hat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, steals your shell right at the beginning.
No, he's around for a while.
Oh, does he?
I wanted to love and play more of this, but it's like everything that is not found in the Souls genre is something that's found in a 5 out of 10 platformer.
It's on the Game Pass, yeah.
It's on the Game Pass.
Hmm. Okay. Ah, there you go.
Yeah.
It's worth trying.
And Front Mission 2 remake also came out. If you like, Front Mission is a Square game that never really came to the US until much later. It started back in the days of the Super Famicom, I think. And it is like an alternate world where it's like a mecha tactics game, but like mecha and foot soldiers and tanks and stuff like that. And it's, you know, like it's sort of like XCOM in that you've got a grid and you're moving stuff around on it and it's turn based. So I played it for, I think, exactly 5 minutes before I fell asleep in my chair because this is the tail end of a bunch of other things I was playing.
I'm familiar with this franchise, but like, when my best Lorne Michaels responding to Bill Hader pitching a Vincent Price sketch 10 years ago, why now? It's like, why now? Why now? Why would this unpopular franchise suddenly become popular?
What's funny is, forgive me, folks, if this is a spoiler, all four of you, they're going to be pissed off at me about this, but I guess that game from 2019, Left Alive, is technically in the series, in the Front Mission series from Square. Do you guys remember that game?
So, no. Like, again, Front Mission is what I call my straight sex simulator.
Yeah,
that's good.
Sure. I don't know what that means. But
I was really bored with my joke.
Fair enough.
I'm looking forward to losing my virginity eventually.
So. Well, keep up the podcast video game book thing like that.
It's gotta work.
It's bound to pay off eventually.
You'd be surprised by how much this show has gotten me late, which is zero.
I'm thinking by my second or third kid, I'll have done it. So
this show is zero. Laser Time used to get you late. This show gets you nothing. Yeah. Right?
I have a cat.
I don't need to hear more.
That's about all it's got. Like,
no,
somehow
no further
I ended
questions,
up with,
Your Honor.
I ended up single, no women, and a cat.
So what he's saying is pussy all day.
No! Ah! Figaro, don't listen. Earmuffs, baby. Earmuffs.
All right, well, that's as good a cue as I need to move on to.
Sony
Car. Oh boy! First item, Chris. It's the movie you've guaranteed us is going to happen, Chris. You've gone on record saying this movie's happened. The Legend of Zelda movie director is not planning on using a lot of mocap in his. Man, this scares me to say that this is how he's referring to the movie. His quote unquote grounded adaptation.
The ants.
Yeah, so Wes Ball is the director. He's doubling down on his plans for the live-action game.
Oh, but he's the director of the new Planet of the Apes film.
He sure is. Mm-hmm. Which I don't know how I feel about that one yet. I got it. I mean, the other new quote unquote Planet of the Apes movie is pretty decent. So
I'm a broken record, but I don't get to say it often. The new Planet of the Apes trilogy is the best trilogy of modern times.
Trilogy.
It is very, very good, and I couldn't be more excited for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. And he's Homeboy said he's going to release a raw version of like just those actors' performances.
That is really weird.
Like, I love it.
Everybody
great.
Just in the suits with no special effects.
Yeah, it's gonna, what he's making is like what is split screen TikTok fodder forever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like even if the movie's a failure, like, it'll look cool forever, being able to see human beings bring these performances to life. The idea of, like, you're working on the biggest arguably the biggest motion capture movie of the moment, and like, I'm not going to do any of that in Zelda.
Well, I think that's that. He learned while making this movie. He clearly doesn't like it, and that's why he's releasing like the raw version. He's just maybe to him, it's just like, yeah, this isn't making a movie. This is just I'm directing a cartoon at this point. If everything in the scene is fake, that's a different medium.
That could be. And there was a bunch of like filmmakers using AI and being honest about it. And like, whatever we tell the AI to do, it doesn't really do that. And like with a human being, like, get that out of here and change that. And I can understand if you're depending on a computer program to interpret your vision, there's going to be a lot more work than just depending on human beings to interpret exactly what you need.
So this is a change of tune. So back in 2010, he was quoted at the time, like, he shared his vision for a Zelda movie back then, and he was saying it was going to be like the next Avatar. So again, a movie pretty much entirely mocap. So it's like, it seems to me the Planet of the Apes has changed his mind about a lot of things.
And I'm not predicting anything again. I'm not trying to predict anything because, like, I enjoyed a lot of the latest Mario movie, but I didn't think it was very great, which, you know, whatever. It doesn't have to be great. Just to be a good Mario is fun. I'm not saying the next one's going to bomb, but I'm saying, like, it's not going to be a post-pandemic major IP movie. It's not going to be as exciting unless it's really good. And if it's not really good, it's going to make less. And whatever that negative response is, the next Mario movie, which is being worked on.
Well, they have to finish Doki Doki movie first, and then can make the Mario.
It's true. Doki Doki Illumination before they can.
that'd be amazing, though.
That would be amazing.
But I still think there's a 75% chance Nintendo pulls the plug on that Zelda movie.
I'll see.
All right. Let's see. This month, it's beginning of the month. We got more free, quote-unquote, games with your subscription services. PlayStation Plus this month gives you EA Sports FC 24.
Oh, shit! The fucking... That's a wakeboarding? What are we looking at here?
That's the football club. That's there. What they call FIFA now.
I was way off. I don't want to play that at all.
I want to say Samsonite. This means that it's sort of the beginning of summer almost here, and don't the next year's versions of the games come out in 2 or 3 months? So this is them being like, hey, we should get you hooked on this style of game so that you buy the next one when this comes out. Destiny 2 Lightfall. That is the only Destiny expansion I did not purchase. So I get to play that.
Congratulations. You're getting it for free, quote unquote.
Ghost Runner 2, another game I really wanted to purchase because I love the original. Mm-hmm. The original got way too fucking hard.
Yeah.
That game got insanely hard, but it was beautiful looking. Great premise. It's like a cyberpunk first person platformer.
The Switch game you made, I told you it was like Jumping Flash. We called it one of our favorite games of the year like a year or two ago.
Yeah, the platformer
Switch PC game. Oh my god,
Neon White.
So good. Neon White, I thought, did what Ghost Runner 1 was trying to do, but a little bit better, and made it more digestible and a little easier to get through those levels. And then fucking another game of the year contender for us, a game probably, looking back, might be my favorite game of that year, Tunic. Tunic's coming to PlayStation Plus. Play Tunic. If you like Zelda and you like Secrets, play Tunic.
If you like Nintendo Power.
Sure.
That's the most fun thing about the game.
Great. Yes. Good. Comparison.
Yeah, and the only other news, Maddie, like, I don't know if you have it in here, but I saw it in person. Sega announced, like, yeah, we're going to make Altered Beast, Streets of Rage, and Monkey Ball figures, and I saw them in person, and they're beautiful. And they actually, they were actually, like, sold out of one of them. Again, leading me to believe, like, adults have ruined the children's toy action figure section.
It's all over. Jesus Christ. Altered like, Beast? Come on.
Yeah. Like,
Wives from your grave.
They are beautiful, inexpensive, and available everywhere, and I thought they were really fucking cool.
Pretty sweet. So the counter side of the PlayStation Plus free games got to go through Microsoft announced Wave 1 of Game Pass for the month. Tomb Raider Definitive Edition.
Which 2012?
I think it's like the greatest hit. It's the game of the year edition of that 2012.
Right.
Was that 2012? Jeez Louise.
I think so.
Kona 2 Brume, or just Broom. It's a game about Kona Coffee, I have to assume, because I haven't played any of these. Little Kitty Big City. Great name. Have no idea what that game is. Oh, here's a game I've heard of. Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons.
Good. I haven't cried enough this year. Great.
Brothers.
Anyway, so that's coming out to Game Pass. And ooh, we got sort of a leak. The Verge reported several sort of leaks on Xbox's alleged release plans for the rest of the year. You guys want to hear them? You want to be spoiled or do you want to be surprised?
Yeah, sure.
No. Like, spoil I have the system that, like, seemingly is getting abandoned but in droves, so let me know.
All right. Well, you know what's not getting abandoned? Starfield!
Starfield!
Starfield is getting an expansion pass. Sharded Space. I'm sorry, Shattered Space.
But it has a new hat.
Give me a one and a one and a one!
And then I think Todd Howard did kind of start talking about some details of that after this came out. The next Call of Duty... Guys, shocker, there's a new Call of Duty in the works.
Madness.
It's probably going to be Black Ops 5,
hmm.
And it's probably coming in late October. You mean to tell me a Call of Duty game is coming in October?
No. Not,
it's too
and
soon.
It can't be Blop Cinco. I hope they...
the Cinco.
The best thing I hope they do is like their history of adding Roman numerals, but just more eyes. Five eyes. Give them to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'll buy it. I will buy it. I'll pre-order it if you do five eyes.
Just skip straight to Black Ops 9. Just to fuck it. Fuck
no, don't do that. Don't confuse me. Don't confuse me.
That would be the fantasy throwback.
Which version of Richard Nixon am I playing in this game? Oh, my God.
Let's see. It's Avowed, which is that new Obsidian game. And then there's going to be a new version of Flight Sim are probably coming in November, according to these reports. And then that leaves Indiana Jones and The Great Circle.
Is that out this month?
No, that's supposed to be December, according to this leak. That's okay. Coming late in the year now. So, again, this is all rumors. None of this stuff's confirmed.
By the way, patreon.com/lasertime for 302010, Diana, JR, and I did a big thing for Temple of Doom on its 40th anniversary. And I wouldn't even plug it here, but we did it like 10 minutes ago before I started this show. And it was so fun. So patreon.com/lasertime.
I think what's interesting about this is the first year Microsoft, the new Microsoft, and they have their kind of release slate and schedule, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of games that they've been working on that were kind of on the Bethesda side, and so now this is the Activision years of Microsoft. So you got the Call of Duty announcement. What does a Call of Duty announcement look like when Microsoft owns you instead of it just being this multi? Yeah. Well, it will still be multi-platform, but... You know.
I'm coloring it from the show. Like, we talked about Double Fine. Double Fine hasn't announced anything since the acquisition of Bethesda. And they will they announce anything when they started announcing Activision products?
Well, so Microsoft did announce they're going to be doing a showcase. So E3 is gone, folks, and yet E3 lives on. Because Microsoft's doing a showcase June 9th, which is right around when E3 would have been. So we'll know a lot more about their actual plans probably after that is what I'm guessing. So, which, by the way, is about a month away. For those of you not keeping score, we're already about halfway through the year.
I want to make it a tradition. The first year I didn't do E3 after... 10 years in the games industry, I was at the largest water park in the world in Wisconsin. I want to be at a water park every year and look at my phone like, oh shit, Psychonauts 3! Oh, whoosh! Whoosh! Like,
time out.
That's the fourth phone I've lost!
I don't want to breeze by what you just said. So you carry your phone around a water park?
Yeah. Not
in a plastic bag.
What? I haven't been to a water park since iPhones were a common thing, so I don't know what one would do at a water park.
It's true. I have over there, and this is a while ago, 2017, undeveloped waterproof camera I bought to take pictures carry around with me. I mean, no idea what's in store for me.
Here's a marketable idea. Again, I'm just giving these out for free.
Pass them out.
Do the Dave Chappelle thing where for a water park for people who are shy about their body, have people seal their phone in a bag before they enter so that no one can take pictures inside the water park, and you get your phone upon leaving the water park when everyone has their clothes back on. Again, I'm just giving these ideas away for free. I don't know what this has to do with video games.
I just had an idea building on the water park for people who are sensitive about their bodies.
Yes, please.
Water dark. It's indoor and dimly lit.
But also, like, if you've ever been on a water slide that the kind that, like, go into the side of a hill that get completely pitch black, there are a few things freakier in this world than that. Than your body suddenly lurching to one side without you having any heads up.
It's super lame, but if you've been to a water park where, like, they have that trap door that the attendant triggers that you don't control.
What?
Yeah, it's a big thing. When was the last time you were at a water park, Michael? I'm going to guess 30 years.
Probably roughly that, yes.
Yeah, like, it does exist, and it's in a lot of water parks.
Is it
like,
how you start the slide? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so like a trap door opens beneath you.
It's not like you're halfway down the slide, and then an attendant opens up a trap door, and you fall into a different
Every time
slide.
A bored teenager's like, all right, we're going to go on count of three, bonk, and then, like, he just dumps you.
I could talk about this so long. Oh, my God. So the last innovation I witnessed at a water park was a slide. I think it was called, like, the plunge or the flush. The innovation there was a giant, like, probably 100-gallon tank that they would fill up behind you and then release all of that water at once to shove you as fast as possible down the slide with deluge of water around you.
Okay, like, so what you're saying is they are still trying to drown us. That's all.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
As long as you keep your head above water, you're fine.
Wow. That was always the plan. That was always
Speaking of people trying to suffocate us to death or drown us. Hey, Razor is getting fined by the
I guess
it's the FTC is fining Razer. No, so you guys remember that? So
yes.
Back in the pandemic times, Razer announced that the Zephyr, it was like a mask that they were touting as an N95 mask, but it looked fucking cool. It had like LED lights built in. It looked like
it had fans, so it wasn't.
It looked like the German raver people meme online, but like a thing I might actually wear.
Yeah, it looked like an Overwatch character.
Yes. So apparently they're getting fined because, they were saying this was N95. It was never certified as N95. The FTC is also alleging Razer misled people because it never actually tested this thing by the Food and Drug Administration in order to get any sort of certification or rating. Razer, of course, disagrees and says, nah, we did our shit, but like, this is so strange.
It's very strange because one, it's a failed product. Like,
because they did actually make it. They actually did.
Yeah, but like, it had it by the time they started putting it out in quantities that people could
buy. It was
buy,
too
like,
late.
Yeah, it was the thing was already winding down.
It was too late. But also, it's like, this is the fastest the Federal Trade Commission has ever gone after someone for deceptive business practices.
Oh, yeah.
It's not oil. It's not cars. It's not groceries. Ooh, this Razer mask. We're going to get them. All my grocery prices are double, by the way. Yeah. So, like, never mind. You do you, FTC.
It's being run by Ogre from the Revenge of the Nerds.
Nerds! I just can't stand seeing those furries around with their LED 95s.
As part of this judgment, I think they have to pay a civil penalty of $100K. They can never make COVID-related health misrepresentations and other unsubstantiated health claims. Guys, we all probably have some things we need to apologize for during the COVID years. We were scared, and things were crazy. And one of those things I need to apologize for is thinking this mask might be something I want to buy and own and wear around.
Well, why do you have
please tell me you're about to put it on right now.
You didn't, like, hawk it to anybody. You didn't say you should buy it.
I really thought Matt was going to put it on right now.
I thought
No. Let's not let him off the hook that easily. I think.
Well, as long as we're apologizing, I'm sorry I ate my neighbors.
Yeah. That's true.
Oh, well, that. Whatever.
I was scared. There wasn't any toilet paper left. I was worried food was going to be next, you know.
And to be serious, like, every once in a while I meet someone like, the pandemic is all a fucking joke. Those didn't work at all. I'm like, millions of people died.
No.
Why wouldn't you just try to not have millions? I'll try anything. If you want me to knock on wood, I will try to not make millions of people die. Like, who cares if this didn't work? It doesn't make the whole thing a farce or a fraud, you dum-dums.
Well, in all seriousness, absolute the reason dum-dums. They're getting fined, but the reason the FTC is going after them is you could interpret this as them taking advantage of people's fears and playing on those fears by basically using false, unsubstantiated claims about a product in a time where everyone was sort of freaking out. Is like, oh, I, because remember, this mask had like reusable filters. Mm-hmm. It had the it seemed at the time like, because LEDs, you know, we were having to, it was hard to find N95 masks, and then you could only use them a few times. It's like, oh, this would be really cool to have a reusable thing. You know, mm-hmm. there's sort of a solution. And yeah, you know, the FTC's like, well, you can't just like say your product does a thing if you haven't gotten that thing tested.
I would actually, now that I think about it, I would kill for a documentary about this product and these people who made it. Yeah. I would love
absolutely.
That.
No, I'd watch the shit out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I bring it up is Razer is mostly known as a gaming peripheral company, which it made it.
I have a couple of mice from them. They're great.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they make good stuff.
Razer's thing is like, you know that thing you already have that works fine? We make a really more expensive, way more
expensive
version.
And a cool version of it with LEDs, and this thing has
and
LEDs
up.
And stuff. But yeah,
it lights up. We made a Toyota Tercel with LEDs. It's like $10,000 more expensive.
We see you, Technogoth kid.
It's sort of a sad but slightly hilarious follow-up to, that's such a weird story from that time. Speaking of stories from those times, you guys remember net neutrality?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Remember how that was a thing that got repealed during the Trump era because it was like, we want ISPs to be able to throttle
certain
internet connections.
That horrible, horrible man in this giant Reese's cup.
They spread the idea that like, net neutrality is like if you look up something, it has to show you a conservative answer and a liberal answer. Like, no. That was never there.
All it is it's like people who can pay more will get their faster internet connections to consumers. And I want to tell you guys, that just got repealed. And get out your gas station sticker. Fucking Biden did that. So
I did that.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
I did that. So from here on out, fucking Rumble doesn't have to prioritize the internet, which it might. It might in 18 months. But
that was such a confusing time because I remember that being like, this is just something that we can all agree on, right? Like as gamers,
what it is.
It shouldn't matter, but let's keep on with the fantasies. Okay.
And not to make this overly long, but I spent a majority of my life as an internet evangelist. This is the best tool humanity has at its disposal if we use it properly. And this was the biggest thing to like make ensure that it's not used properly. And blah blah blah. I think, did you see that thing last week? Like, have you tried Googling something lately? Doesn't it suck and you just like go right to Reddit if it doesn't show you the Reddit results? And then people are putting Reddit 2022 in there so you can see the results from 2 years ago because AI has ruined every single internet search in the last 2 years, last 18 months.
Yeah.
Automation, and not just AI, automation.
Well, so enjoy your net neutrality. It's back. Thank you, Joe Biden.
Back, baby.
Thanks, Biden.
Like the McRib. Let's move on to the community segment, which is always a segment in our community. Last week's question of the week, what games did we miss in our top five? Which game nailed it in a series? So, Phil, to explain this, our top five last week was about games that perfected a style of gameplay. For example, Zelda Link to the Past perfected what started in the first Zelda. But it's just like, this is the shining exemplar in this series of this type of gameplay. Everything else is lesser than or completely different. Do you have one that stands out to you?
Did anyone say, and I listened, but I'm trying to remember, did anyone say Red Dead Revolver 2?
Do.
Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah, I wanted
Red Dead Redemption.
It's not that I hate, but on 302010 this week, Red Dead Revolver is 20 years old.
Good lord. Right.
And Red Dead Revolver. So this is officially a 20-year-old franchise which the first one has no bearing on none. What the franchise would become.
Nope, none. Not at all. Yeah.
That was such a jump to me. And frankly, we live in a world where I'm amazed that anything that's Western themed is going to do as well as that game did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
I would only argue with you because I love both Red Dead Redemption games. Mm-hmm. That I think Red Dead Redemption 1 actually fits the spirit of this way more. Like, because to me, Red Dead Redemption 1 at the time was like a perfect game where it took this thing of like, well, we're trying this with Red Dead Revolver.
For the time,
RDR1 fucking nails it, you know. And then 2 is just more and everything you loved about 1, but just like they pile on so much more and it's higher fidelity and everything like
that.
Yeah.
I think that's totally fair. Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
That and Super Mario 2.
Mario 2 haters. Oh my god, I can hold up the box right here in front of me. Yeah. Oh, suck a dick, everyone.
Does it exist? Like, who is a Mario 2 hater? Like, I've actually never met one.
We just did a Temple of Doom thing, and like, Temple of Doom was a controversial movie. I'm like, when like 90-year-old white men were reviewing it,
it's kind of a weird outlier in the franchise, and yet it is the most like what Indiana Jones is supposed to be, like this globe trotting.
That's
1930s.
That is exactly what I should have said on the show. I love this answer because from Bree Stafford.
Yeah, Bree Stafford on the official Laser Time community on Facebook. Bree Stafford says, for me, one of the best examples of a sequel perfecting the formula of the first game is We Love Katamari. Yeah, that's a great answer. The first game is an absolute blast, but the sequel improved the controls, added new goals, introduced collectibles that included other playable characters, and increased its level replayability with a quest system. Though I never personally played the multiplayer mode, I still feel like was another great addition to the series that the sequel introduced. Also, despite the first game's soundtrack being great, We Love Katamari somehow has a better collection of songs, which includes a definitive version of the series' theme song. Katamari on the Swing, Katamari Damashi rolled so We Love Katamari could fly.
That series burned bright for such a short time, and then we were all kind of overstayed its welcome.
My YouTube algorithm is so terrible because I have we have premium YouTube for the show mostly, so we can play clips with no ads. Because every time I'm somewhere, we're like, this is how many ads YouTube slots in for a 10-minute thing? Jesus Christ.
It's only getting worse.
Horrible platform if you're having to deal with that. But for us, because we play so many, whatever. My girl's like, put on some music. I'm tired of hearing leftist politics and wrestling podcasts.
Bite your tongue.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why are we even dating if you're in this? and the fourth entry, and I haven't done this in years. It was the Katamari soundtrack.
Oh, so good.
And she's like, what is this? And like, it's even weirder than the music would imply. Katamari Damacy might be the world's most perfect game because it was made by that Michael. Do you remember the guy's name?
It just escaped my mind.
I think We Love Katamari is the last Katamari game he actually worked on.
Keita Takahashi.
Yes. Yeah, because he's like, I'm not a game maker. I don't have an interest in this field. I don't want to work here. I don't want to work in this franchise for the rest of my life. We Love Katamari was like the most charming sequel ever to a 19. Remember that game released at 1999 in 2001 when every game was $50.
Yep. That guy's games also like have an amazing way of speaking to non gamers. Like I remember playing Watam with my young kid at the time. And like Watam, if you're approaching it as a gamer, you're like, what the hell's going on here? If you just approach it as a playable toy, it's perfect.
Yeah, and I'm talking to my girl who's my age and, like, you know, games spent years alienating her from the whole medium. But, like, no, you'll love this. And, like, this music will make sense when you see the game. And I showed her the game, like, this is not charming. Katamari, really good. Something I might not have pulled out because, like, after We Love Katamari, every version was not good.
It's just how much more of that did we
diminishing need? Returns.
Diminishing returns. Yeah. But the original guy didn't work on it because he like, how do I build on this? You rolled up the world at the end of the game.
That's it. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
What else are we gonna do? Gonna go make a game about noses and poop. Yeah.
Jesus. See, Curtis Bellanger says, Jedi Knight Dark Forces 2. The original Dark Forces is good as a Doom clone, but the sequel adds a lightsaber, force powers, and a host of amazing villains, all framed with beefed up visuals and FMV. Playing the game as a kid, it was like getting a whole new Star Wars movie. I liked the recent Dark Forces remake, but here's hoping they can give some love to this game as well.
I don't think the brand has any cachet, but like, That is one of those franchises that changed everything every time. Because the next one was Jedi Knight 2.
Yeah.
That's unrecognizable next to Dark Forces.
And on Jedi Knight 2, like, I did not play that as intended. Because, although it sort of resembles Dark Forces in that, if I remember right, you can switch back and forth by playing it as a first-person shooter and then as a third-person lightsaber game, which is how most people are going to play it. I turned on the dismemberment cheat, which basically turns contact with lightsaber, like if you touch an enemy with your lightsaber, it's an instant kill and they will fall apart. I fucking loved that. That was so much fun.
That might be a thing Disney won't allow you to do again.
Yeah, maybe I think not. You might be right. Which is sad.
We have a dismemberment system in here. If you put in a code, like, I've worked on games. That's so hard to do.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
We want kids to come to our theme park. We don't want to paint it with this.
We don't want a bunch of black knights running around here. It's just a flesh wound. Threads.net. This is what I call justice for Tony. A framework on YouTube.
Braxtatax
says, I'm really happy that Banjo-Tooie got mentioned because it was the first game I thought of when I heard of the premise, followed quickly by Mass Effect 2. In retrospect, I don't know that Tooie should make any list because I think they made it too large and expansive. My answer, though, would probably go to Ratchet & Clank Going to Commando. Is that the third game, Michael?
I think that was the second one? Okay, Going Commando and then up your arsenal? I forget what order they go in.
That was when I officially recognized, like, they're going to be funny titles forever. My answer, though, would... first game was fun, but you could tell there was a lot that could be refined, and especially in the combat. They added so much in the second game between the levels. He's saying this is the second game. Character growth, weapons, especially the weapons, and the writing. They're all just top-notch. Special shout-out to Psychonauts 2. Yeah, totally. Braxtrax. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Phil, do you want to read CSL 316?
Absolutely. Twisted Metal Black, being a fan of the series, is a roller coaster. After two, it was just a bad time. So I wasn't expecting anything from Black, but I got one of the best games on the PS2. It has everything you'd want from the series: fast, challenging combat with perfect controls, unique cars that all feel different, expansive levels that are fun to master, and super memorable endings. It's David Jaffe's masterwork.
Wow.
They follow this up with Small Brawl, so the roller coaster continues.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's like, it comes back, it's like, yes, this is the big comeback. It's back on top. Oh, no, it sucks again.
I think that's inarguable. That's the apex of the series in general.
Can I tell you guys, this is the only Twisted Metal game I've spent any significant time with, and I kind of feel like I nailed it, and there's no need to play another one until they...
You're all set.
...to Black.
Yeah.
No, you might be done.
That's the best one.
Man, Willie Freshness says, Uncharted 1 was a decent adventure romp, but still felt like the product of the PS2 era. Uncharted 2... came along and knocked it out of the park.
Hell yeah.
Set pieces like the train level and the collapsing building chopper fight really elevated the series and Naughty Dog to blockbuster level. Absolutely. I made a joke while we did our commentary for Temple of Doom. I'm like, Uncharted invented this. Because it takes so many Indiana Jones moments and turns them into playable things, which is something games had never been able to do until Uncharted 2.
And I love all the games, don't get me wrong, but when I say that, like, I feel like Uncharted 3 was like, wow, that was really good, like 2, but boy, it's starting to get a little bloated. Then 4 came along and we're like, whoop, wow, it's whoop, even more bloated. Like, they really, like, 2 kind of nailed it in the length. This is all I need out of an Uncharted game. Yeah. It doesn't need to be 30 hours.
Mm-hmm. Still think it's the best. There are plenty of people who say 3 is the best, but I say they're wrong.
I think 2 is the best as well.
All right. Well, we're on the same page. On Blue Sky, Bisky at Wolf Studios Art says, Time Splitters 1 was a buttery smooth FPS, but its single and multiplayer modes were very bare bones. Time Splitters 2 gave us a great single player mode with different objectives, a great variety of multiplayer maps, and a map maker, tons of challenge modes, and a huge cast of fun characters. It's a shame the series ended at 3.
I think if there were different hosts on the show, we would have had that in the top 5.
Mm. Yeah, I probably played the shit out of Time Splitters 2 to the point where I forgot there was a Time Splitters 3.
I'm kind of embarrassed that I didn't think of this.
Time to split. That was my impression of Time Splitters Future Perfect.
Oh. Hey, another game I thought of, but I didn't love the first one enough to really care. But Matt Quintanilla says, Half-Life 2. Shit, man. The first game did a lot to bring us out of the Quake era, but the sequel codified so many things. Codified? Yeah. But the sequel codified so many things.
Made them like cod, the fish. Yes.
Yeah.
Delicious and smelling.
The Icelandic staple.
Yes.
It codified so many things we take for granted. The set pieces, implementation of physics, puzzles, even the ability to mod the game were perfected so thoroughly they haven't made a 3.
Yeah, that's the reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they nailed it.
I mean, not because they nailed it, but just like... Half-Life 2 was trying to sell, like, vaguely trying to sell the world on both Steam and the Source Engine.
It wasn't vague at all, and it totally did both really well.
No, it did.
Although that, like, it's weird that, like, that originated the Valve can't count to 3 thing twice, and then it's just like, all right, we're not going to make Half-Life 3 yet, we're going to make 3 DLC episodes. Remember when they were called episodes?
Yes.
And like, we're
twice.
Gonna, we do the first 2, and then we never do the third one.
And then we do a VR game.
Because, like Half-Life became a thing I think that nobody wanted to make because there's so much, as a creative person, so much pressure around, this needs to move the... Do you understand what that's... This doesn't... Can't just be good. It has to move the medium forward. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of pressure to make a game like that, especially when you have infinite pockets like Valve does.
If you put that pressure on yourself, you're never going to make a game.
It's true, and we saw that with like Duke Nukem, but remember, Duke Nukem didn't also own the leading PC software distribution platform.
That's true. I was going to say.
And so like, if you've heard interviews with anybody from Valve, like, they've been making more Half-Lives forever, but there's no reason to make one unless Valve is pushing something new, and they haven't really... They put their clout behind VR and a little bit, and that's where you got a new Half-Life.
Yeah,
Half-Life, they had their
Alex
own headset.
Alex is really good, but it's also a prequel, so it's not going to resolve that cliffhanger for anyone.
Right, but it's like a big thing needs to happen within Valve for them to bother following through, because everybody who works there says they've been making them forever and they scrap them every time.
Unfortunately, when you own the preeminent PC distribution platform for digital and you can sit there and collect money for just hosting a store, like, what there, I hate to say, but there's not much impetus to make another Half-Life.
Right. Have you heard from people who quit that job? It's just like, I was here to write games. The woman who does the puppeteering for the Red Fraggle worked at Valve.
Really?
What?
Yeah. She's how we had Wheatley. Like
damn.
That's what she did. They all have quit Valve because, like, they don't make anything because Steam is just this money-making machine, and they'll keep paying you to work there and make nothing. But, you
There's
know,
no motivation.
Creative people need to branch out. And That's my favorite thing, though. Yeah, the woman who did Red worked at Valve for years.
Damn.
You guys heard Chris. He just said, you got to starve creatives, man. They need to want
it. No. All the people who quit seem wealthy beyond their wildest imagination.
Sure.
Yeah, but like, why would you die in the hill of a 7 out of 10 if you're Valve, right?
Valve, if you want to hire someone and pay him to do nothing, I do nothing like a darling.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Check
his LinkedIn. I've endorsed him for that.
I not only write dick jokes for games, I can deliver obese people champagne on their yacht very easily.
Absolutely.
He's lost a lot of weight. I'll just say that.
I mean, well, I need his formula because I'm gaining much, much more.
Yeah. Red Speedo or blue? Just let me know.
That guy got red speedoed back in 2016.
He took the red speedo. I would love to get slapped in the ass by Gabe Newell, like, meh, right? It's just too many bubbles. Slap. Gabe. Oh, Gaben.
Why do you keep doing the meh?
Yeah.
He's Edward J. Robinson.
Yeah, I'm working on my 1940s.
That's like that Shane Gillis bit where he's like, the last time white people sounded cool is when they talk like that. Like, man.
Oh, Gabe, you're such a tart.
On Twitter, at G says that, says, Super Smash Melee, every version since the N64 has just been adding to / tweaking the GameCube version. Honorable mention to F-Zero GX / Arcade Cabinet.
That is an excellent... That is the apex of F-Zero.
Yeah, the F-Zero Gex crossover. Who can forget? Yeah.
Stop it. Stop it. We're talking about the Triforce here. The Triforce, the Sega, Nintendo, Namco. What I learned, it's a GameCube with an extra chip in it. But Sega and Namco making a F-Zero GX arcade cabinet.
Like, dogs and cats living together.
No, that's, it's right. Excellent, and you can only play it in arcades. Like, it hasn't been ported anywhere. So, like, if you want to emulate arcade games, go for it. But, like, it's hard to recreate that being in that chassis. It's fucking great.
All right, so new question of the week. Again, building on our top five, tell us about your favorite beautiful flop. What's a game that you love but that you know did not succeed commercially?
I know this intimately because my favorite game I ever worked on at Capcom, that I thought, like, other than Monster Hunter, which I kind of got into there, what I thought was their best game was DMC.
That's a good one.
Great game. Great fucking game.
Did it fail? I know people complained about it a lot, but...
It was a very weird period of where, like, games need to sell 10 million copies, and, like, you have, like, 8 games that have done this over the period of 30 years. So, like, how is this supposed to do this out of the gate? But DMC... Again, the fans were really mean to it from the beginning, from the whole launch period. And then I don't think we're very fair to it. And, like, the more the game gets released, like, this is really fucking good. And Devil May Cry 5 is totally different, and it's awesome that they can exist in the same universe. And, like, oh, Christian Bale Batman is just as fun as Mr. Vengeance Robert Pattinson Batman. Like, these are both great things that can exist, should have coexisted a little longer. But I'm taking from Michael just to – I want – Beyond Good and Evil to get in there because,
how dare,
like,
you?
I feel like it should have been in general because, like, that game gets better with every generation. It does so many things really well, including my favorite. Have you not heard me say video game cutscenes and acting are terrible in almost all cases? We were talking offline, like, Matt's like, oh, Diablo 4 has been on Game Pass for a while and it's really fun. I got it, opened it up, and just, like, it took 7 seconds of a live-action cutscene, like, I don't care.
And, like, and skip that. You don't need to watch any of those.
I know, but, like, the money was spent, you know? And, like, None of those stories have been as impactful as Beyond Good and Evil to me.
As Jet Boots!
The Jet Boots!
I just need someone, a creative listener, please create a coexist like that Christians or the religion sticker, but just with Devil May Cry imagery, because Chris talking about those two games coexisting is...
It's fun to think about, because they're all games that were like, they reviewed well and people didn't respond, but eventually... I think the games media and people, influencers, got a hold of Beyond Good and Evil and DMC, and they're undeniable. Mm. They're undeniable.
I got to let our guest go because I'm going to cheat. Yeah. I rarely have two answers, but I have to have two. But I want to make sure he goes so I don't steal one of his answers. But I have two such good ones, I have to get them both out there.
This might sound a little cliche, but I have to go with Spec Ops: The Line.
Dude, okay. That game is great. Okay.
Yeah. It was such a game changer. Oh, pun intended. It was that thing where all the games critics were talking about it. It was one of the things that made me want to get into games journalism. It just slipped under that radar because it was kind of a COD.
Because gamers who knew what Spec Ops was, like, this is the $20 shitty series.
Exactly.
That doesn't do anything new.
And that surprise and that, like, that level, it's chaos when you think of it. It's insane that someone got their hands on that franchise and got to turn it into what they did. I remember the loading screen accusing me of being a monster.
Do you feel like a hero yet?
Yes, just fucking blew my mind apart. Oh, yeah. So I'm going to have to go with that one.
Privileged to have the writer of that, Walt Williams, on the show a bunch of years back.
Oh, that's awesome.
And he's an
awesome episode.
His book is really interesting, where he talks about it and other things, and like why the console version of Serious Sam has like a giant pyramid as its boss, because they forgot to put it in.
Oh, gosh.
I think it's interesting that like Spec Ops: The Line gets discussed to death back and forth. Mm-hmm. I keep hearing people saying like, you know, it's brilliant the way that the game like, you know, forces you into these situations and then, you know, asks you to reflect on them. And it's like, you should feel bad about this. And I've seen other people say like, oh, it's so ham-fisted the way it tries to force you to feel bad about it. But it's like, but you're still talking about it.
Right.
You're still talking about it. Interesting.
Right. There's a ton of, like, the Helldivers adds a white phosphorus grenade the next update.
Mm. Oh, man.
White phosphorus is ruinous and, like, one of the most gross things you could ever, like, imply to a human being ever.
Without question.
But what about bugs? Giant space bugs.
Bugs and robots.
Yeah.
It is heavily rumored all the robots are former people.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh,
no.
Oh, boy.
So it's all happening to them, too. But like, again, my favorite Spec Ops, though the one I may not have said, I remember I played it in a hotel room during GDC. Which is where all the AAA people, they wouldn't put their shit on the floor. You go in the hotel room. And I talked to all these fucking people from IGN, GameSpot, and like, is that good? Is this good? What the fuck is going on? Like, we were hesitant to take this appointment. Yeah. What's going on? And I wrote an effusive preview. And it's my favorite pull quote ever. If you ever look up the trailer, the guy leaps off of a tattered highway and does a rock slide across my text quote. And it was, this game sets my brain on fire.
Wow.
That's awesome.
I don't want to set your brain on fire.
Spec Ops: The Line is a really good one because there is no other aspect of that franchise you should save in a fire.
None whatsoever.
So here's my lesser entry that I'm glad you didn't quote these, although Spec Ops is a great choice. Eternal Darkness to me is a GameCube era defining game. That game,
did it flop?
When you think of the game, at least when I think of the GameCube, it's like, that's like one of the first games that pops into my mind.
Huh.
Not really a success. Only sold 500,000 copies.
I think it might have flopped for Nintendo.
That's the thing. First party game. Mm-hmm. That's not great. Okay. And now another first party game, and this is Sega in play here, but Shenmue. Shenmue is my... That game was beautiful. I loved it. I loved the Dreamcast era. To me, it's one of the definitive Dreamcast games. You know, allegedly sold more than a million copies, but like, it had huge production costs, blah, blah, blah. The stories are out there. Go look it up. But like, I love me some Shenmue. And it is... I've said this on the show before, like, without Shenmue, you don't get Yakuza.
That's
true. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that game set the mold.
I don't
for
think you get
so
a lot,
many games.
A lot of things. I think Shenmue is looking forward to live games more than anything that it is. And Shenmue 3 was just like, ugh. it's a new version of this outdated style, but like, it was supposed to be a persistent game that mm-hmm. you lived in.
You can miss entire events in that game because mm-hmm. the game operated on a schedule. And you could just right. dick around yep. and buy capsule toys all day long and miss shit, you know? And yeah, it was ahead of its time. And yeah, Shenmue's great. You should play Shenmue if you haven't before.
All right. I'm going to say you should play Vanquish because Vanquish.
You motherfucker. You told me this didn't belong in the top five. And I couldn't bring it up because you would kill me.
He did. I said he no did such off. Thing. I did sort of say, like, I'm not sure if it's as much of like a prominent flop as some of these other ones. I think what's interesting is that I remembered it not getting very well reviewed
at
the time. It has like a 90 Metacritic, something like
Does
that.
Does it really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remembered people complaining about it because I think a number of critics were approaching it like Gears of War. And even though it has a sticky cover mechanic, it's not meant to be played like Gears of War.
No.
It is meant to be played at breakneck speed. You are meant to run yes. straight into the bullets and just play balls to the wall all the time. And like, that's how I really like to play games at the time. So I took to it like a fish to water, and it's like, this is amazing. It's just like high speed, run up against, you know, run through a hail of bullets, start just beating the shit out of robots with my fists, and then I'm shooting some more, and yeah, it was a lot of fun, and it's ridiculous.
I took a bunch of appointments with it with the developer at the time.
Platinum Games.
Yes.
I forget who it was. It wasn't, you know, Captain Baldy or whatever his name is. But he's like, well, the weirdest thing I've ever heard, like, well, I started smoking again, so I made the character smoke. Like, what? what a thing that wouldn't exist right now.
That's amazing.
But he was
no
also like
on this ship.
I love shooters. I hate reloading. It's the future. Every weapon should use the same energy. And so you don't pick up. That's the thing about the game. You like all your guns use the same energy. There's cooldowns, but they're very mild. Mm-hmm. And like you can use any weapon at any time. And you have ample ways to, I remember calling it deep knee rock slide across an entire map.
Well, like Gears had the roadie run, this had the rock star slide where you're just going knees first into everything.
Wait, was the guy you were talking to Shinji Mikami, like the director of the game, like the, you know,
no,
Resident Evil
so.
and Tango Gameworks guy? Wasn't that guy? Okay.
I would have known who that
The game has was. A pedigree is what I'm saying. It was also published by Sega, so thank you.
It's very good. And it's like the only game I can think of, we did a top five, like, it's awesome when a game kills the president.
More games should have knee pads, is what I'm saying. More games should have you fucking sliding around with knee pads.
Yep. Sure, Matt likes knee pads. I like killing presidents. But
are you bad enough dude like to kill pads. The president?
Yes! With your knee pads?
It wasn't up to me, but it was like an America with a Hillary Clinton-esque president who was fucking murdered. It's dope, and it's weird. And
well, she's not exactly murdered.
I'm a big champion of weird. Weird is great. Games industry needs more weird.
Vanquish is great.
Yeah, play Vanquish. It has a remaster. So
it's $6 on Steam.
Oh, nice. Perfect. Yeah, go grab that. So, yes, what is your favorite beautiful flop? Tell us. Go to the official LaserTime community on Facebook. There'll be a thread there where you can answer. Or ping us on Twitter, Threads, and Blue Sky. At VG Apocalypse, and we will read the answers on next week's show. That has been our show. Let's go out with some plugs. Phil, once again. Where can people find you?
Phil?
Oh!
Phil?
You can
Kiefling?
Find Kiefling. The Kiefling. You can find me on the site that dare not speak its name at He Makes Monsters. You can find me at pixelitpod.com. Come check us out. And you can find me on Amazon for my first horror novella, Juice. It is murderous winemaker time. It's a cross between American Psycho and The Little Shop of Horrors. If that's not enough to get you going, then I didn't write the book for you. So come and check me
this
out.
This wine was aged for 8 years. Like, yeah. Most people don't know that.
Yeah. Most people.
Why are you lying down?
Wine's so catchy. Do you like Malbec?
I can. Of course, Patrick Bateman loved wine. Of course he did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's not in the books, but he did.
He did. Or he pretended to.
And Pixelit looks... I'm going to listen
Pixelit
as soon as I can.
Pixelit is a phenomenal podcast. Everyone should go listen to that instead of this. It's also much shorter. It's around an hour per episode.
Yeah, but it's an untapped aspect of gaming that like most people wouldn't put the effort into.
And we get into a lot of, you know, honestly, it turns into discussions on adaptation in general, leftist bullshit that we because we're only human. And at the end of every episode, we go into our segment called What Are You Playing? Where we talk about the games that we're currently playing. Because
what are you playing?
What are you playing?
I am still on, if I could be leftist for a second, Helldivers Forums. Where people who scream democracy and kill everyone, like, don't put politics in my game. Like, what are you talking about?
I think this is the fourth time you've invoked Helldivers. Does that mean you're summoning Helldivers into our shared space here?
I mean, maybe you're just playing terrible games of all day for work. Mm-hmm. Helldivers is the shit and the best game of the year.
Still haven't played that yet. Fair enough.
It's pretty good.
I'm just going to plug Pixelit. The Pixelit podcast about video game novelizations. Because if you can't play video games, you should fucking read a book. Read a book.
Damn right. Yeah. Matt can suck my dick. Patreon.com/LaserTime should have got a way bigger plug earlier on. Early. I didn't hear what Matt said, but I'm sure it was funny.
I said I would strap on my Vanquish knee pads and slide on over, pal.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. One of my favorite pieces of footage in history is Bruce Springsteen doing a rock slide when he's a little too old, and his dick takes out the cameraman. Right. And it's so funny. And he, like, helps him up and, like, sorry, man, I kind of sexually assaulted you.
Please tell me that was incorporated into the latest season of Curb. Like, please tell me they talked about that on Curb, because he's in there, okay, right?
I hate... sounding very boomer, one of my favorite TV moments of the year is Bruce Springsteen on Curb. I'm like, ugh, you're a floor fucker, Larry. Like, that was Bruce Springsteen who said that. Awesome. Awesome.
I hope that was improv, because a lot of that show is. You know?
Mm-hmm. Take one for the boss. It's an honor, sir.
Patreon.com/LaserTime. Never-ending story shows coming out by the time you hear this. New Indiana Jones thing, Meaning of Life, Holy Grail, Monty Python. I'm so tired. It's very late.
Okay. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Threads, and Blue Sky at VG Apocalypse. Follow me personally at Wikiparaz. That's WIKIPARAZ. Thanks for listening, everybody. That's our show. We'll see you next week.
Like, I have internet porn. Why would I need a dancy lady?
I'm sorry. Have you had biscuits and gravy at the Gold Club at 2 a.m., my friend?
I did have a friend who was kicked out of Cafe Risque, which Florida boy might know, because he wouldn't get his scrambled eggs off the stage. He, like, he was not looking at the girls at all. He was being super weird. And just, oh, what? Are you doing something? I don't care.
Oh, go, man.
Free food. Mm-hmm.